I have a
for life.
Yeah. And I do that about every 2 weeks.
Good morning. Welcome to the March 16th, 2022 meeting of the Board of Directors of the Eastern Municipal Water District. We will always start with our Pledge of Allegiance. And Director Corona, would you like to lead us
this morning in our pledge?
Please raise the flag. Ready? Begin. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
May I ask the Board Secretary to call the roll of the Board of Directors and then to follow that up with the procedures for our virtual teleconferencing?
Yes. Director Corona?
Here.
Director Slauson?
Here.
Director Armstrong?
Here.
Director Record?
Here.
And President Pauly is here, as well as our legal counsel. I will go over the EMWD guidelines for virtual participation in our board meetings. To avoid creating acoustic feedback, please mute all your devices during the meeting unless you are speaking. Before speaking, please unmute your device and turn down the volume of any other devices that are near you and tuned into the meeting. If you have joined by phone and would like to comment on an item, please press *9 now to let our staff know and wait to be notified. When it is your turn to speak, you will hear a notification asking you to unmute your phone by pressing *6. If you have joined by computer, you may use the chat feature in Zoom to indicate your desire to speak. When done speaking, please mute your device again. Please participate from a quiet environment so that the board can hear you when you are speaking.
Very good. Thank you so much. April, do we have anybody wishing to address the board during public comment this morning?
Not that I'm aware of.
Very good. Thank you for that. We will then begin with our general manager's report. Mr. Mawad.
Good morning, President Pauly, members of the board. My report is included in your packet. Under new and ongoing items, pleased to report that last week, the federal omnibus appropriations bill was released and included $2.5 million for the Quail Valley septic to sewer program, as well as $1 million for the Mead Valley booster station project, as inserted by Congressman Calvert for the Quail Valley Initiative and Congressman Takano for Mead Valley. We really appreciate their longstanding support of EMWD. As a result, last week the House and Senate passed the omnibus, and last night President Biden did sign it. This year, as you're aware, was the first year that earmark funding was restored after a 10-year hiatus. As this great news was being announced, our staff is already working on identifying, putting forward the next round of projects for consideration by our representatives for earmark funding for fiscal year 2023. Also, last week, I'm pleased to report that the Riverside County Board of Supervisors approved funding for EMWD for three projects in the Mead Valley and Good Hope area. The funding that was approved by the Board of Supervisors totaled approximately $5 million, and the three projects include the Cahalco Corridor Sewer, the Cahalco Corridor Water System Improvements, and the Good Hope Olive Area Water System Improvements. We're very much appreciative of Supervisor Jeffrey's support for the funding and the entire Board of Supervisors, and we are currently working on developing the project participation agreements that we will bring forward to this board for consideration. Also, we're working very closely with Supervisor Washington and his staff, and it appears that the supervisor will be recommending for the Board of Supervisors' consideration approval of funding for EMWD in the approximate amount of $10.5 million for three projects, including two projects in the wine country area. So more to come on those details as we finalize our discussions with the county staff. But I just wanted the board to be aware that those discussions are ongoing. Also, yesterday, I'm pleased to share with you that President Pauly, myself, and EMWD staff participated in our virtual 2022 Sacramento Advocacy Day. We had the pleasure to meet with several of our delegation, including Senators Roth, Melendez, as well as Assembly members Mays and Medina, in addition to the members of our legislative delegation. We had the opportunity to meet with Assembly member Kahan, who is the new chair of the Assembly Committee on Water, Parks, and Wildlife. During the meetings that we've had, we had an opportunity to share an overview of EMWD to those who are not as familiar with us. Many of them are obviously very familiar with our efforts. But we also shared an update on the current drought, as well as our ongoing response to the drought conditions, as well as our budget priorities and state legislative priorities as well. Next item on my report, I just wanted to share with the board that on March 1st, the governor issued an executive order suspending the current emergency temporary standards associated with the COVID-19 pandemic. And shortly thereafter, Cal OSHA stated that face covering requirements for unvaccinated individuals indoors will no longer be enforced. As a result, effective March 7th, EMWD removed the requirement for unvaccinated individuals to wear a face covering indoors. As always, if circumstances change, EMWD will continue to follow Cal OSHA guidance and provide notification to all staff accordingly. Under items of interest to the board, wanted to share with you that Western Municipal Water District's General Manager, Craig Miller, and Western's advocacy consultant, KP Advocates, are planning to launch a statewide advocacy program to urge state leaders to prioritize, fund, and advance major water initiatives in the state, including Delta Conveyance, large-scale storage, such as sites, as well as provide regulatory certainty. EMWD has been invited to participate and contribute to the effort in the amount of $30,000 to help fund the advocacy effort. I'm working with Craig to better understand the group's specific goals as well as the group's strategy and tone. Once we receive the detailed advocacy proposal, we will further discuss at the Executive Committee for feedback and direction. Lastly, I just wanted to share with you that last week I participated in the National Water Reuse Board meeting and strategic planning effort, as well as the 37th Annual Symposium in San Antonio. It was an opportunity to collaborate with the other board members to develop the strategic priorities and path forward for the water reuse organization. It was also an opportunity for Eastern to be recognized once again by our colleagues as a leader in the water reuse industry. Eastern was honored to receive the Award of Excellence in Transformational Innovation for our closed-circuit reverse osmosis pilot project. That concludes my report. Be happy to answer any questions the board may have.
Director Slauson.
Yes, one question on Craig Miller's proposed organization. How would you explain regulatory certainty?
So, we have not received the detailed proposal yet from KP, but my understanding is that there is a desire to have a streamlined, for example, CEQA approach to projects so that large-scale projects are not hindered due to environmental requirements. I believe that's the concept, but, again, I have not received those details.
Okay. At least one of the articles I read considering UC Berkeley's limit on enrollment based on CEQA requirements, and I guess they overcame that, but they said the legislature might be open to reconsideration of some of the CEQA requirements. Okay, thank you.
Absolutely. Yeah, Director Armstrong.
Just a comment. I just wanted to say congratulations on, on the omnibus appropriations and the success there, and even moreover on the Riverside County ones. I know that you have been meeting with the county on a more regular basis and having that open dialogue, and I'm sure that helped, and all the other efforts with the supervisors. But that's just great results. So congratulations.
Thank you, Director Armstrong.
Director Record, any questions for the general manager?
No questions, thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Joe. Laura, do you have anything for us this morning?
Yes, President Pauley and members of the board. I'm proud to announce that EMWD has been named a finalist for Best CIS Implementation for Customer Service Week Expanding Excellence Awards, which will be presented at CS Week in Phoenix, Arizona on May 4th. The Expanding Excellence Awards program honors outstanding accomplishments and innovations in utility customer service. I'd just like to thank Charles and Dan, they're here today, and the rest of the EMW team working on the CIS project for all their dedication to this project and to know that this award is very well deserved. So thank you.
Very good. Thank you very much. And I do recognize our two customer service stars in the back there. Nick, do you have anything for us this morning?
I have nothing this morning.
Very good.
Good morning, President Pauley and members of the board. Late last year, Brian Powell retired from the position of Director of Water Resources and Facilities Planning. And after an extensive search that included very talented and experienced internal and external candidates, I am very pleased to introduce EMWD's new Director of Water Resources and Facilities Planning, Ms. Laura Barraza, who is here today.
Very good. Welcome.
Laura is a registered civil engineer. She has a bachelor's degree in both chemistry and in engineering. She has over 20 years of experience in the water and wastewater industry, as well as 10 years with EMWD, serving in the position of a principal civil engineer. She oversaw our water and wastewater planning and has performed critical hydraulic modeling, both in the support of those planning efforts as well as response to emergency events. We're very fortunate to have Laura serving in this new position, and I welcome her to this new role.
All right. Do you want to say anything? The floor is yours. Oh, well, very good. It's an important role.
I would just say that, welcome to the new position. We've seen you here before. You've done a good job. And I would just add, bachelor's in chemistry, that's really exciting.
Mr. Melendez, anything for us this morning?
Good morning. We have two large transmission lines that run north and south through our Paris Valley pressure zone. And the eastern pipeline is a 33-inch steel line. It sprung a leak just outside of our ski land ponds, right outside the fence line. It's a large dirt lot where the leak occurred, happened 2 days ago. It was a pretty large a leak, and so we've been having some issues trying to dewater the pipeline and get down to make the repair. So staff are still working on that this morning. So just want to make you aware that that's going on. The demands are such that it's not an emergency at this time. The rest of the system has more than enough capacity to maintain service. So we'll keep you updated through the weekly reports and next meeting how this repair has turned out.
Thank you very much for that. Any questions for anybody? Very good. We will then go on to our consent calendar. I understand Director Slauson, you'd like to have a separate vote on item N, is it?
Yes, that's it.
And Director Armstrong, did you want to pull an item?
I don't, but I would like to make a comment before voting.
Okay. Be my guest.
Oh, okay, sure. I have a comment on item 3E.
Okay.
And that is the proposed resolution for JCFA with the City of Paris. And I've had the opportunity to be briefed on some of the efforts that staff has been working on in relation to analyzing our CFD policy and sort of the results of it over the last 10 years. And I know in a couple weeks that report is going to come to the full board, so there's more to come on it. But I've seen enough to know there's some very compelling reasons why Eastern should continue to lead CFDs, and there are some real benefits to our customers to have Eastern lead these CFDs and actually form some of the CFDs. And while I still have some personal opinions about some of it, there's nothing I can back up with any data or empirical evidence, but it's really convinced me that this is important. So I know there's more to come, but I just wanted to make that comment because I'll be voting for these, and so I wanted to just make it clear why I changed my position on it. That's my comment.
Very good. Let me ask before we take a motion. Laura, when is that report coming before the board?
April 6th.
April 6th. Okay. Thank you so much.
I'll move the consent calendar.
Moved by, except for item N, moved by Director Corona. Would you like
second.
A second? Director Armstrong, may I get a roll call vote, please?
Director Pauley?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
That passes 5-0. Director Slauson has left the podium, so I'm going to go ahead and make a motion on the consent calendar item N.
Would you like to second.
Director Corona seconds that.
May I get a roll call vote, please?
Director Pauly?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
And that passes 4-0 with Director Slauson not participating in the item.
And President Pauly, can I add before Council asks, I'm abstaining because of a potential conflict of interest because I've done work for KB Home.
Very good. Thank you very much on that. That will take us to our action calendar and item A, which is to approve and authorize a professional service agreement with Plant Moran for Enterprise Resource Planning and Development Services Management System Phase 2, consulting service not to exceed $498,000. Mr. Adams, good morning.
Good morning, President Pauly, members of the board. Let me pull up our presentation here. So today I am excited to be in front of the board along with Corey Wallace to present this item. This is really an update on phase one for both the ERP and development services assessments. And as you can see, part of the recommendation will be to approve a phase two process and a consulting agreement with Plant Moran. So with that, let me move to the next slide. So here's the outline for today's presentation. I will provide a brief background and timeline so far. I will highlight some of the current challenges that we have with our current systems. These are challenges that the board are familiar with that we have provided in past presentations. I will talk about the completion of the phase one assessments. Specifically, I will cover the major outcomes for the ERP assessment. Corey Wallace will do the development services assessment and the major outcome. We'll talk about the results. Then I will go into phase two and discuss sort of the steps that we anticipate as part of the phase two, including chart of account redesign, the procurement process, and the pre-implementation planning. And then I'll cover next steps, the cost and the budget for phase two, and then, of course, the recommendation for the agreement. So as the board is aware, these projects are part of the district's district-wide strategic plan. The ERP was a project that was identified in 2018's plan, and staff has been working on that since then. In the summer of 2020, after pre-planning for phase one and the assessment, the district did issue RFPs for both finance and development services, so separate RFPs for those assessments. In December, when I first got here, Corey and I did do a informational item for the board in December, providing that sort of that highlight of what the assessments would include, some of the current challenges and opportunities that we had with the potential of a new system. In January of last year, we actually had the board award two different agreements, one with SDI Presence to do the ERP assessment, and then Plant Moran to do the development services assessment. Today in the audience are representatives from Plant Moran, Chris Bau and Mike Grossman, who were part of that assessment and will be part of phase two. And then that project actually took about 9 months for both assessments, and those were completed last winter. I think the DSMS was in October and the ERP was in December, which those complete reports were part of the packet for the board today. So just to highlight some of the current challenges, these are not new for the board, but just sort of just for the benefit of the audience. First, we have two systems that are legacy that were installed and started implementation in the early 90s. So these systems have certainly provided tremendous value for the district, a great return on investment when you think that these systems we're still using even after 25-plus years. But with that said, we all know technology has significantly changed over the last three decades, and so certainly there's a great opportunity to replace those systems. One of the major challenges that we have is our current chart of accounts. This was designed back in the 90s, and so really, really designed for the processes and practices that we had. Our business practices have significantly changed as of, you know, currently. The segments in many cases have reached capacity, and we have had, you know, have worked, have created workarounds to address some of the reporting challenges. With these older systems, we've had technology sprawl. We've added additional systems that are separate. to provide functionality. A good example, which I'll highlight later, is our budget process, a completely separate system, not integrated at all with our ERP. Of course, with that, we've had poor integrations, which certainly hampers our reporting and analysis. And then really on the development services side, the development services system isn't as integrated as it should be within the ERP. Two different siloed systems, duplicate entry, and certainly a lot of inconsistency on data. So with that, I'm going to cover phase one, and I'm starting off with the ERP. So as mentioned, SDI did the assessment. It really started in February of last year. This had district-wide kickoff with stakeholders, with each operational group throughout the district. I think there was somewhere in the neighborhood of 16 individual meetings with different groups within the district. They documented our current practices. They identified process improvements. They ended up creating a report that identifies key issues and gaps that we currently have. They did discuss budget in that presentation or in that report. And that report's 140 pages. I have done my best to sort of summarize really the major outcomes on this one slide. So over 90 findings are included in the report, really can be categorized into six major areas. Certainly the chart of accounts we knew going in is not designed for our future business needs. One of the things that is not currently in our ERP is a project ledger. And this is really a key part as we talk about the amount of capital planning that we do, the development services component, really tracking costs at a very detailed level for projects. And so the chart of accounts has been used to do that. And without a project ledger, that has been our workaround. So one of the key findings or outcomes is to implement a new project ledger that will help not just with our capital program, but our grant accounting, a lot of benefits. The other one is workflow. Certainly with newer technology, automated workflows, electronic workflows for approvals, the current EBS system has some but haven't been fully utilized. A new system would have more sophisticated workflow, electronic workflow processes, for automation and approvals. Our budget, as I mentioned, completely separate from the financial system, requires a significant amount of manual downloads and uploads as we go through the budget process. Very time-consuming. System complexity, this is really geared towards our HR payroll system. We have significant outside external professional support supporting those systems, which is, you know, in our environment today is very costly and doesn't really help staff be as effective as they can. And then lastly, with the technology sprawl, our integrations and interfaces are very complex, very time-consuming, and in some cases ultimately are manual and need to be replaced. With that, I mean, one of the key findings on the DSMS is that currently that's separate, and there's an opportunity that that could be better integrated with the ERP. With that, I'm going to turn over to Corey to cover the DSMS outcomes.
Thank you, John. I am also real happy to be here today to talk about this effort. We've worked a long time on it and really excited about proceeding with the phase two efforts. Like John mentioned, the development services phase one evaluation effort was done separately. It was done because of its specialized nature and significant touch points across various departments and functions within EMWD. I wanted to highlight, too, that development services is currently experiencing elevated connection activities, and we're fast approaching the upper historical range of connections at 5,000 per year. So that trend has been steadily increasing since the COVID period, and I don't expect that that's going to change anytime soon. So it just makes this initiative even more important to kick off and implement. And I want to acknowledge Chris and his team. Last year, Plant Moran led the development services evaluation, and we did 20 detailed process discovery interviews where 29 current state process maps were developed that encompassed 450 business activities. And these were developed to define the business system requirements, understand opportunities and gaps that would be remedied by a modern solution that ultimately would enhance service to the development community. I mean, that's the end goal. Our phase one deliverables, they are included in the board package. They are large documents as well. The needs assessment report outlines the major recommendations and opportunities, and the implementation strategy outlines the procurement strategy, which John is going to talk about on coming slides, as well as the one-time and recurring costs. With the development services systems being obsolete and unsupported and unintegrated, like John was mentioning, interruption of these legacy systems would be concerning and detrimental to our operations, and we're fortunate that things are still operating, and we try to maintain those the best we can with our resources. Also, with the outcomes, a modern platform and development services, there are several things that are highlighted. Integration, that's key. Workflow automation and simplification. We did look at how we can simplify our business processes with a modern solution and found that there are about 100 business processes that we could probably streamline down to a more manageable level and integrate. Also, customer service, self-service and transparency. We're proposing to have a portal that the customers can see their project, their status, upload documents, and be part of that communication with staff. We're trying to eliminate paper with electronic plan reviews and document uploads, as well as integrating dashboards for staff just to look at performance and trying to manage that. So all these opportunities are intended to provide efficiencies and time savings with staff as well as the overall process for development. So with that, I'll turn it back to John.
So ultimately, both assessments had recommendations to procure and replace current systems. As you can see, SDI's was focused on improving workflows and efficiency gains. Plant Moran really focusing on, as Corey mentioned, customer service and serving those clients. With that said, they also did estimates on costs. And what I want to highlight here is really separate analysis done by each of the consultants if these were projects that were done by themselves. So on the ERP, the low end at 9.3 up to the 13.6 million, DSMS 2.7 to $4.5 million. Now this is all in cost, so consultant cost, staff cost, all the efforts that would be required during that implementation phase, which could be anywhere from 18 to 3 years, depending on which portion. With that said, the annual costs are shown there as far as the low-end total of about $900,000 to $1.5. Interesting, our current annual cost is really in the middle of that range currently. We spend just a little over $1.2 million supporting all of these different systems. This provided the opportunity to sort of take a look at phase two and the approach on phase two. And with these separate assessments, there was a great opportunity to sort of combine those paths and go through one procurement process that would look at both of these systems in a very more integrated approach, with the potential of one software provider providing both, or at least identifying two software providers or separate software providers that would have experience in integrations that would meet the district's needs. So phase two, in addition to the system procurement, would include some pre-implementation planning, contract negotiations, and one of the key findings from the phase one assessment, which is our chart of accounts redesign. Certainly in this marketplace, there are a fair amount of software providers. I think it's it's prudent and ultimately efficient for the district to do one two-step process to really identify the best course forward. So with that, the first really key element prior to issuance of the RFP, or at least in the middle of the RFP, is our chart of accounts design. This is really the foundation for the ERP, really needs to be designed to support the organization for the next two decades. We do have a preliminary project team that will be led by our controller that will work very closely with Plante Moran. Plante Moran has done chart of accounts redesigns for large agencies as high as a state to just a normal water district. So they have a lot of experience, really can guide the staff, not just our finance staff, but our operations staff and people that actually utilize and track costs. So this would also include the implementation or at least the design of the project ledger, as that process will be included and will be separate ultimately from the chart of accounts. Next is this two-step process. And I think what we've really identified is to do a two-step process where we do a request for information to identify what we're going to consider a shortlist, but really to identify the top software providers that can provide and support the district's needs going forward. So this process is going to be between 6 and 8 months. We really are going to, you know, have a complete evaluation team really identify those top providers that meet our needs. And then during that process, as we do some of the functional requirements, we will do a full-blown RFP process, and that will be for those top providers. That will certainly will gain experience from the RFI, and then we'll further be able to dive in through the RFP process on the ultimate selection. With that, assuming we're able to identify one or two vendors, Plante Moran would help with contract negotiations. Contract negotiations on a project of this nature is going to be critical. As we've seen in other projects like CIS, it's going to be a key point in defining the scope and the work and ensuring a successful project. So major activities by Plante Moran is really to negotiate that, to resolve issues, to identify those activities that are going to happen during implementation. This could take 3 to 4 months. In the unlikely event that they're unproductive, we will, go to the next most qualified vendor, but with the goal of really coming with the best solution at that time. Pre-implementation planning, which is also part of phase two, as we talk about contract negotiations, we will start the planning process for the implementation, really identifying the project core team, the structure, the timeline, and really ultimately the budget, really to get the organization ready. From contract award to implementation could be anywhere from 4 to 6 months, depending on coordination with the consultant or the software provider or integrator. This is going to be really important to identify that team and be prepared once we're ready to start the implementation. So next steps, this is phase two. So the phase two has really, as I mentioned, several components, which we highlight here. There are estimated hours on this budget, which is almost 2,000 hours with 250 hours in contingency. The total cost is just under $500,000. This is going to be really the, us hitting the road with getting prepared for that implementation. We feel that the hours and the timeline, are maybe a little aggressive on the time. We're looking from 12 to 15 months. We're going to build in some buffer, but really feel good about being in front of the board next summer with a recommendation. So here's the schedule. Chart of accounts design can really is independent of really the RFI or RFP process. It will start next month. Could take 6 to 8 months, will be important as we issue the RFP and evaluate systems. The RFI will start immediately with the goal of evaluating software providers in July and August and issuing an RFP in the fall. I highlight two key points for the board. Step one, the results from phase two The software providers that we will recommend to the board, we will bring prior to getting into deep contract negotiations, where we will have budget estimates, timelines, and some of the other challenges or opportunities that the district will have. So that will anticipate, you know, around April 1st, we will be in contract negotiations and then come back to the board with a final contract, hopefully in June. So with that, the recommendation today is to authorize the general manager to enter into an agreement with Plant Moran for $498,000 and to proceed with phase two. So I'm available for any questions.
Any questions for John?
No, I think it looks like a great program. I think we need to continue forward.
Director Record, any questions?
No questions. Happy to make a motion.
I have a motion. I just want to say first, I appreciate Plant Moran being here today. As you know, I like when we are spending big dollars that people take the time and come to our meetings. So I do really appreciate the fact that we have a representative here. We have a motion by Director Record.
Second.
Director Armstrong, you'd like to second that. May I get a roll call vote, please?
Director Pauly?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
That passes 5-0. Thank you very much. Item B is to adopt a proposed resolution of the Board of Directors of the Eastern Municipal Water District approving the prepayment agreement with Lake Hemet Municipal Water District, authorizing the early payoff of the Phase 1 agreement and partial 2016B bond deference.
Morning,
Good
President.
Morning, sir.
Good morning, President Pauly, members of the board. I'm going to cover this item verbally. There's no presentation for this item. It pertains to approving a prepayment agreement with the Lake Hemet Municipal Water District in regards to them paying off a loan that they have with Eastern. Bonds were issued in 2008 to fund several projects, including facilities related to the Hemet-San Jacinto Integrated Recharge Recovery Program. And a portion of the bonds sold to finance the recharge recovery program were later agreed to be paid by Lake Hemet Municipal Water District, the City of Hemet, and the City of San Jacinto as part of a settlement agreement with the Saboba Band of Luseno Indians. These three agencies plus Eastern entered into an agreement known as the Phase 1 Agreement as part of the formation of the Water Master to provide for the construction and acquisition costs of the program facilities. Total cost was estimated at $24.8 million, and grants funded approximately $5.2 million. The rest was split up across the four agencies based on a pro rata share of the costs. Included in the agreement were payment schedules for these agencies to pay Eastern, since Eastern had essentially fronted the money for this. Lake Hemet recently approached the district about paying off their loan early, and the original debt issued in 2008 was later refunded in 2016 and is not callable until 2026. So the district hired PFM to assist with the calculations and to ensure that the district recovered all of the necessary costs, including bank fees, legal fees, interest costs, et cetera. To date, Lake Hemet has paid approximately $6.8 million. And the gross payoff amount now is $5.8 million, but because the bonds can't be called for a few years, the funds will be placed in an escrow account earning interest. The estimated interest earned is about $224,000, so the calculated net payoff is about $5.5 million. Lake Hemet's Board of Directors approved the payoff agreement, and their general manager signed the prepayment agreement back in January. Now, since there was other agencies a part of the original agreement, we reached out to those agencies, and we've received some interest from the City of Hemet, but they are not ready to proceed with the prepayment. So we'll continue to work with them, and when and if they're ready, we'll be able to facilitate that. The work we've achieved with the Lake Hemet Municipal Water District has essentially provided us a framework for future calculations for the other agencies, when and if they're ready to prepay the rest of their loan. The recommendation for this item is for the board to approve the prepayment agreement, the escrow agreement with U.S. Bank, and authorize the president, GM, or DGM to sign the agreements and authorize the partial bond defeasance. Now, there's two action items required today, one by the Eastern Board and then also one by the Financing Authority. So the Financing Authority will convene later this morning. And the reason for that is because in 2016, when the bonds were refunded, they were refunded with the Financing Authority, and so they're also a party to the escrow agreement. And so that item, we'll need to get approval for that later. I'm happy to answer any questions on this. I know it's a lot to take in with no visuals, but happy to do so.
Yeah, just one question. The only way Eastern would lose on this is if the interest rate we received was less than you anticipate, which is unlikely.
Correct. And so the interest forecast has to do with slugs. And so it'll stick with the current market and the way the market shifts. And so as we estimate the payoff from them, it'll be placed in the escrow account. And so the interest that the escrow account receives should be closely related to the current market. If it goes up, it earns a little bit more. If it goes down, it goes down a little bit more.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
So, Thomas, not only did you not have visual, but there were no puns on this one either. So just so I understand, so we're taking action today, but the payoff really isn't going to happen because the city of Hemet is not going to take action. Is that
sorry, this actually is for the Lake Hemet Municipal Water District.
Okay,
they're ready
you
to take action.
The city of Hemet.
Yes, so because there were three other agencies, because we were doing this process with Lake Hemet Municipal Water District, we reached out to the other agencies to see if there was interest. I was just providing an update. City of Hemet is interested, but not ready yet. So this item is just pertaining to the Lake Hemet Municipal Water District.
Gotcha. Okay, I misunderstood.
Sorry about
that. I apologize.
But it is delayed until the bonds can be called at the later date, and that's when it will be paid off.
Correct. So Lake Hemet Municipal Water District will wire us money. The money will go into an escrow account, earn the interest related, closely to the market, and then the bonds will be defeased later.
Thank you for that. Director Eckert, any questions on this item?
No questions.
Would you like to move the item?
I'll move it.
Okay, Director, I'll have Director Record move it. Director Cronus second it. May I get a roll call vote, please?
Director Pauly?
Aye.
Director Cronus?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
And it passes 5-0. Thank you, Thomas, for that. Item C this morning is to approve and authorize an agreement with Allyshire and Winder LLP for General Counsel Legal Services.
Thank you, President Pauly, members of the board. As the board is aware, recently we were notified by Stephen O'Neill that he and his partner, Keith Lemieux, as well as the water attorneys and their team are planning to leave OMLO and join the firm of Allyshire & Whitener. So with that, we that change will be effective as of April 1st. So with that, we engage in discussions with Stephen, and we have developed an agreement before you today for continued legal counsel services, having Stephen O'Neill continue to serve as our primary general counsel attorney, which he has done so since 2012. So in those discussions, we also developed a fee schedule that is included in the agreement. I should mention that the fee schedule is comparable and actually slightly lower than the fees we had for OMLO. Having said that, there is a annual adjustment based on CPI that will be effective starting July of every year, with July 2022 being the first implementation of that CPI annual adjustment. With that, I'll be happy to answer any questions, and Stephen is also available to answer any questions regarding this proposed contract with Allyshire.
I don't have any questions.
No questions. I just want to say we're coming up on 10 years of having Steve here, and I just want to say I think he does a superior job for this district. So,
my question is, so you're going to keep the same office and just change the name on your door? Is that what you're going to do? Or are you going to?
Yeah, we have our office has always been where it has been. But it'll be integrated into this new firm. But the new firm is based in Irvine with an office in El Segundo as well, and will be a satellite office where we are in Thousand Oaks.
So you don't have to get rid of your library or anything else?
Yeah, well, most law firms don't have libraries anymore. So it's all here. But, yeah, we still have some of those old books, unfortunately.
Good. That's all I have.
Director Record, any questions, or would you like to make the motion?
Sure, I'll make the motion.
Motion by Director Record, second by Director Slauson.
Absolutely.
Roll call vote, please.
Director Pauly?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
And that passes 5-0. We will move on to our informational items. We are going to do the financial operating and capital highlights to the second quarter. Mr. Adams, welcome back.
Yes, good morning, President Pauly, members of the board. This morning, I plan to give you an update on the second quarter financial statements. Sort of key, it's mid-year. We did spend some additional time, which I'll go into, really doing some analysis on not just where the first 6 months, but really projecting out, which I have a few slides on, which is different from normal presentations. In addition, we do have the second quarter capital highlights in which Lynnette Alexander will provide an update on how we're doing on our capital program. Just in general, I think you'll see we've performed really well on the operating side. I just sort of highlighting what operations have done to really watch the budget, really planned very well last year, and you'll see from our projections that other than a couple areas that we weren't completely expecting, we're in pretty good shape for this year so far. So with that, here's the standard topics to discuss. I'll cover the enterprise as a whole, talk about some of the key points there. I'll briefly go into water, sewer, and recycled services and the operations, G&A, and other. I'll have Lynnette cover the capital, and then there's that bullet point for 21-22 projections, and then sort of a summary conclusion. So consolidated, I know this is always difficult to read. Highlighting on the second bullet is, revenues, operating revenues are a little over 4% higher than projections. Operating expenses, very tight, 1.9%. Operations, really keeping an eye on the budget and doing a really good job there. I highlight the first box, non-operating revenues. Corey mentioned it earlier. The connection fees continue to be significantly higher than we anticipated. Very similar to last year, which you'll see a graph on. The other one is, as you know, late fees were implemented in September. I don't think we were anticipating those when developing the budget until the first year. So other revenues are a little higher. Property tax, we did make some changes in the way we record property taxes as on a receipt basis, not based on the lien date. So with that, operating expenses, again, 1.9% under, very tight. In non-operating expenses, the one that I want to highlight is debt. Because of interest rates being low, our variable rate debt has been significantly less as far as interest costs, so those expenses are low. So that's been a benefit and really has offset the reduction in interest income. And then finally, as a couple of the members of the Retirement Committee know, we have this $19 million to fund those unfunded liabilities. In December, we did make a $4 million payment to CalPERS, but that's not really it was an expense that went through the operating statement, and so it's not shown in that $19 million. The $15 million, we made two payments of $5 million first of the month, yesterday $5 million, and then another $5 million will be by the end of March. So next time around on the third quarter statement, you'll see $15 million there. So overall, positive net operating margin performed better. And this is pretty typical for us at a mid-year, as we're usually in a better position at mid-year than budget. So moving on to water service, acre feet up, sold really across the board. I think the big one is irrigation and Lake Hemet, who has pulled, wholesale water from us. You can see there, we talk about total operating costs, $1.3 million, $1.8% under budget at this time of year is really good. You'll see as a theme, our energy costs are higher than budget. Partly a catch-up billing with SCE, but just the increase in gas and electric rates We did do increases, but certainly you'll see as we talk about projections that those are the two areas that will be over budget. Overall, water in great shape. I highlight some of the domestic sales, just 3% higher, but we had a lot of growth last year, and that contributed to it as well. And then, of course, Lake Hemet, that was higher than budget and higher than past years. Oops, going the wrong way. My fault. Just, again, this is the summary, 5.3% overall on revenues, 1.8% under. In comparison to last year, operating expenses are up from comparison of last year, which would make sense with the increased costs. And then you can see the variance from prior year in water. So wastewater, very similar. Overall, wastewater revenue a little tighter, just 1.5% above budget. A lot of that's fixed costs, as you know, or fixed fees. And then operating just under $1 million under budget. Again, very tight when you're talking about a $100 million operation. Again, here you see revenues 1.5% up and operating costs 2.4% under. Just to highlight in the middle, you see energy 20% over budget. So, again, some savings in other places, achieved by operations, but energy costs, something we can control to some extent, but the increased costs we can't is above budget. Recycled water, very similar last year, 2% above prior year in sales as far as, but the makeup of those sales have actually generated more revenue above budget because of retrofits and some of the other uses that pay a higher rate. Again, you see to the right, energy cost higher in this case because of a delayed billing with the upgrade to the SCE billing system. Again, here are just the highlights. Look at operating costs, just 1%, a little less than 1% over budget. Again, really being driven by those increased energy costs. So G&A, is, in good shape, under budget, but above prior year. We highlight a few key things. Of course, labor expense is lower because of vacancies. We do budget 100%, so that has some built-in buffer there. And with the cost of living adjustments, which I'll talk about projections, which went into effect in January that were higher than budget, we still anticipate labor to ultimately come in under budget. Just to show you how reserves have increased over the past year, in September we do have some large debt service payments, so there's always the decline in September, but reserves, $643 million, a significant amount, of course, with connection fees and other revenue coming in. This is the slide just to show you EDU connections. The red squares are the projections, and that, is our conservative budget for this year. You can see that it's trending closer to last year, where we were just over 4,500. Corey mentioned 5,000 connections. So right now we're projecting 4,726 for year-end based on looking at trend analysis over the last few years. So, again, a lot of connection fee revenue coming in that will support future capital. Operating fixed assets, certainly the vehicles are under. This is just, really the timing and the time it takes to order. You can see the IT infrastructure above budget, but a lot of that has to do with the CIS project coming to an end. With that, I'm going to turn over to Linnea to cover the capital improvement program.
Good morning.
Good morning again. You'd think after all this time I'd have this down pat. All right. Our five-year capital improvement program has a total budget of $534 million with an estimated external funding of $79 million. And our water and wastewater projects make up the bulk of our CIP, with water system investments making up the majority of that over the next five-year period in the average amount of $61 million per year. And within this current fiscal year, you can see again that our water projects are making up the majority of our CIP program at 66%. And 94 of the 181 current active projects, or $70 million of the $106 million budget. And the pie chart on the right shows that the majority of that spending is being done in the construction phase of these projects. This graph shows our performance over the first two quarters of this fiscal year. As previously reported, we had a little bit of a slow start in quarter one, but we have made up a lot of that ground in quarter two, and we are now at about 90% of our actual costs are about 90% of our budget cost for the current fiscal year. Our top five project expenditures so far for fiscal year 2021-2022 include the Murrieta Road Transmission Pipeline Improvement Phase 1, the Sky Canyon expansion, which we just reported at the last board meeting, has been recently completed, Paris 2 DeSalter, which we are nearing the startup and commissioning phase, and Paris North Cactus Corridor well drilling, which is a component of our overall Paris North groundwater contamination remediation program, and the Temecula Valley Regional Water Reclamation Facility Stormwater Assessment and Improvement Project. We also have several construction projects that have been completed so far in the current fiscal year, again, including several projects under our ERRP program, as well as I wanted to point out the Warm Springs Creek Sewer Crossing and Erosion Mitigation Program, which was an urgent project that was completed for the protection of that sewer. This project, or this slide, shows a summary of recent construction bids for the first two quarters. And really, the main takeaway for this, you can see a variation of, in that far column to the right, black and red, the difference between engineers' estimate. And really, the key takeaway on this is that we are still seeing a lot of volatility in the market. So we have some that are coming in a lot lower, some that are coming in a lot higher. But on average, we're only about 3% higher than the comprehensive engineer estimates for these bids. Now we have a handful of slides that just highlight a few projects associated with each of our strategic priorities. We have projects that are providing infrastructure to increase our supply diversity and reliability. Also, continuing to advance our initiatives in water recycling, including advancing to the next phase of our purified water replenishment project that has recently started in the final design phase. Salinity management, including several projects in which we partner with the Army Corps for funding. Protection of public and environmental health, and as Joe reported, on Quail Valley, the recent funding potential from the Omnibus Bill, and then also planning and appropriate investment. Some key highlights from the first two quarters of this fiscal year include securing additional $5 million in funding to support the Paris North Groundwater Contamination Remediation Project, also completing four net energy metering projects under our Solar Phase 3 initiative, completing the construction of Mountain Avenue replenishment basin as part of our Groundwater Reliability Plus program, nearing construction on the Paris 2 desalter, I mentioned PWR updates, as well as continuing to advance the Quail Valley project. And with that, I will take any questions and turn it back over to John.
Could I ask one we have not calculated in the potential ARPA funding from the county yet on any of this. Is that correct? Or
that is correct, President Pauly. So our CIP plan is being updated accordingly.
Absolutely. Okay. I just wanted to make that clear that we more good stuff to come is what you're saying.
Yes, and Joe reminded me you also have an update of these project highlights and more in the booklet.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Any other questions? I'm sorry. Not so far. All right. Continue.
All right, so a little different for this mid-year, and we didn't do this last year, but with inflation, cost increases that we have seen, the increase in COLAs by the MOU, really felt it was important to take a closer look, not just as expenses at mid-year, but really try to project out for the next 6 months for the remainder of the year. So just quickly on wages and benefits, a little busy, but you know, initially we anticipated cost of living adjustments at 2%. 4.5% was what ultimately the index came in at. We do, you know, our vacancy rate is between 3 and 5%, and so we have some built-in savings there, and we really took those projected salaries going forward and projected where salaries would be, and you can see we still anticipate being under budget by 4%. Health insurance is going to be very close as far as that's a major expenditure on the labor side. For other benefits, that 10% or that $2.7 million is really caused by that CalPERS payment, that $4 million. So overall, you know, based on our projections, labor, both wages and benefits, will be right on budget. So just, you know, really from that aspect of having that additional cost of living adjustment, but with the vacancies, we'll offset that. So we should be in good shape related to that.
Can I ask you a question on
that? Yeah.
Just on the unfilled vacancies, that I'm just curious if we're having a challenge filling vacancies, or if it's just sort of a timing. It's just sort of timing.
It is timing mainly, but yeah. It is more challenging right now to fill vacancies. But we always have vacancies. It's just the nature of the beast, the size of the organization that we are.
Yeah, and it you know, we look at about 640. Positions that are authorized, and that number, if you look at the GM's report, ranges from that, you know, 605 to 620, you know, filled. And so,
and the only thing I would add is that we've had a lot of retirements, and I think we counted 61 last year over the year. And so, you know, trying to keep pace with that, plus just people leaving, it takes a while for the vacancies to be filled.
And I would just add, Dr. Armstrong, we're obviously working very closely to fill those positions, working closely with our recruiters and HR. But to the point that John made, historically, our vacancy is around 3% of the 630-some authorized positions. Because of the significant amount of retirements that occurred, especially late last year, we saw a number of retirements by the end of the calendar year, the vacancy is up to 5%. Of our entire workforce. So we are down to, as of last week, 604 employees out of the 636, I believe, authorized, or somewhere around there. So it is a challenge. We're working through it. And frankly, the pace of retirements will continue this year. And I see it. I think we all see it. So we're working very hard to develop our succession planning and make sure that we're going to be able to provide you know, our mission and services uninterrupted, but it is something that we're having to very much actively address, and I know Laura and everyone on this team has been very focused on it.
Well, I know there's always been this discussion of, you know, retirements and this getting to this point where there's going to be all these retirements and not enough people to backfill those positions, and so I didn't know if we're like kind of experienced the front end of that, or if it's just, you know, or if it's, you know, just the pressure in the labor market right now today, or, you know, not finding good qualified candidates, or, you know, just what. But
I think it's a combination of those things that you just described, Dr. Armstrong. Absolutely. So I think many of us in the water industry are vying for the same pool of candidates. Yeah. So it is a challenge. It's not just unique to Eastern. It's I've talked to other general managers, and they are having similar challenges.
And I think that's why I think we brought one reorganization to you to really look at how we manage our business, and we'll continue to look at how we operate, and if we need to do restructuring, we'll bring them forward.
All right. Moving on to service areas, worked closely with Matt Melendrez and his staff on looking at the service areas and really projecting out costs, not just looking at current costs, but also projecting out costs. And just at a very high level summary for water, we, you know, in projecting out where our current costs are through the end of the year, really projecting to be about 1% under budget. On the wastewater side, anticipate to be a little above budget, $250,000 projected, and then recycled water, again, a little over budget as well. I think overall you can see very tight when you talk about some of these larger operations. So really good from that perspective. We did highlight chemical expense. You've heard there have been significant cost increase. The operations staff in developing the budget anticipated those increases, but have also been managing that expense. And we anticipate that being under budget. Just a couple key count variances, and this is really the one I want to highlight, was the energy costs. We took a look district-wide on both electric and natural gas, and certainly those are large operating expenses that we anticipate being over budget. For electric, 16%, and natural gas, 50%. Luckily, on natural gas, it's only $1 million, but still $1 million. Overall,
only
another
$1 million.
Yeah, 50%. So I, going and just looking at these are really major categories within the operations and the detail that went into looking at them and projecting out. So really, on the energy costs is where we're seeing those increases. So really, in summary, I think, as shown from an expense side, projecting out the remainder of the year, I think we're in good shape. We don't anticipate asking for any budget adjustments going forward. This does raise the question about budget adjustments for the second year of our two-year budget. We will be coming back, I think, focusing probably on the salary component as that will have a rippling effect going forward. And we'll take a closer look at operations overall, probably adjust the energy budgets accordingly as well. But at this point, no major surprises, no major concerns. Really just highlight the consolidated. Overall operating revenues over budget. Sales are a little higher than anticipated, but operating expenses very tight and under budget. Outside of that, connection fees we talked about significantly above budget, and that will continue. Grant revenues, certainly we've been successful and continue to be successful, and that will be updated in the CIP plan coming forward. So with that, I am available for any questions.
Any questions? Dr. Armstrong?
Just when you went through some of those expense items, I'm curious, maybe at operations and engineering would be a good place to talk about it, but just with our fleet and what's happening with fuel costs, I don't know, you didn't touch on that in here.
Yeah, and interesting, I believe there's a update coming on fuel. I don't have what they anticipate as the impact, but certainly we've, on the fuel prices and stuff, have seen those increases. But I can get back to you, unless Laura knows. I don't.
Okay.
Off. But we did, looked at operations overall, and I'll follow up on the fleet. It's a good observation as far as the.
But I would imagine in their analysis, it didn't. Year to date, it didn't show.
Right.
It didn't.
Projecting forward.
Yeah, it wasn't a major.
Yeah.
Even though the increase, the percentage may be a higher percentage higher, the overall impact.
If I can add, Dr. Armstrong, we will likely see that impact in the second half of the fiscal year. Obviously, with this report that covers up until end of December, we did not experience the recent spike in fuel prices that I think we've all seen. Yeah. So we will take a look at that when we come back next quarter for reporting.
Okay. Yeah, and just going to Joe's comment, I mean, the mid-year analysis was done, 6 weeks ago. And so certainly with the Ukraine and those changes, we hadn't seen the significant spike. But there were increases there. So any other questions?
Director Record, any questions on this item?
No questions. Good report.
Very good. Good report. So I think what I'd like to do, I know the recycled water rate study is probably going to be a lengthy item. So why don't we take the water budget item next, and then we'll take a break and come back at exactly 10:30 for the financing authority, if that's April. Are you prepared to take item C?
I am.
All right.
Good morning.
Morning.
Thank you.
So as we head into spring break, I'm headed to spring break soon. The state's water supplies obviously have not been replenished through the winter season as we would have all hoped. So this information item is really timely in that it's important to categorize what our water supply contingency plan looks like in comparison to our water budgets, but the most important aspect being that we're not anticipating having to move into another regulatory stage if we are not mandated by state. So with that, I just wanted to put into context that, you know, EMWD has a history of diversified water supplies and excellent conservation from our customers. So as always, we're in a very good state for our water supplies, but we still wanted to provide some background and context for what a water shortage contingency plan aspect would look like. So the purpose of this item is to show how those things interact. So we'll start with water budgets. They were originally implemented in 2009 at 60 gallons per person per day and 100% of evapotranspiration, which is the water that's needed to sustain turf grass. So that's assuming turf grass is on 100% of the designated irrigated area. As time went on, in 2011, some conservation factors were applied to properties that were built on or after January 1st. And the reason for that is more efficient irrigation system technologies. Again, in 2015, we were at the height of the last historic drought. So additional conservation factors were implemented for even newer homes that were established June 1st, 2015 or later. So at that point, we had 100% ET homes, 70% ET homes, and 50% ET homes. The 50% ET homes really was to encourage the water-wise landscaping for life, meaning we didn't want to have non-functional turf in homes. So there were some new landscaping requirements related to the model efficient landscaping ordinance, and new development adhered to those requirements that sustained a 50% ET budget. This also helped to address some of the concerns during the drought about new development continuing in our area that's only 38% built out. In 2017, again, based on some new state water use efficiency regulations, we did adjust our water budgets to 55 gallons per day for everybody. And then everybody that was at the 100% ET setting was dropped down to the 80%. So to provide some additional context for EMWD budgets, especially compared to other agencies, first I wanted to give you guys an idea of who all fits into each category. We have 87% of our customers that are on budgets within the 80% ET value. The 70% ET customers, we have about 5%, and then those that are at the 50% ET value, we have about 8% of our customers. By comparison, Rancho California Water District also has different ET values. They have 75% and 60% based on a square footage for irrigated areas. And Western Municipal Water District has an 80% and 70% similar to ours in that it's based on when a home was built. And then Elsinore Valley is still at 100% for block landscape areas. So now we'll see how the budgets work with our water shortage contingency plan. So we are at stage 3A. Which is, there's no reduction in our water budgets for stage 3A. The only thing that we are not permitting are the variances for refilling of swimming pools, establishing new landscapes, or not repairing leaks within 48-hour time period. So it's really just encouraging the water waste, reducing that water waste. If we were to move into stage 3B or 3C, we still wouldn't see a reduction in water budgets per se. We would simply eliminate our first penalty tier. So anybody using water over their budget would immediately go to the highest penalty tier. Stage 4 is when we really start to see some impacts to our water budgets. And again, we don't anticipate having to move into one of those new stages unless we're mandated by the state. So to provide some background, the last time we did have mandatory outdoor reductions was during the last drought. For all of the customers that we had back then at 170% ET budgets, a drought factor was applied, and we also created a floor. So They were reduced, but the floor that we created had a 50% ET budget. That also meant that for all the customers that were already at 50% ET budget, they did not have their water budgets reduced because they were already at an extremely efficient budget. So I provided some examples to show what that actually looks like. As an example, a 100% ET customer with a 30% reduction went from 11 billion units in their total budget, or I'm sorry, their landscape budget, to 8 billion units. Vice versa, somebody that was already at 70% went from 8 billion units to 5, but the 50% ET customers remained at the 5 billion units. So just to reiterate how we did this last time and what we have as our authority for future any drought stages, it's in our administrative code, our water shortage contingency plan. The language allows us to establish a floor by giving us the ability to temporarily adjust to maintain or establish efficient landscaping during a drought. We do plan to update that draft language in a future admin code update to just really clarify what that means in terms of being able to establish a floor of 50% ET under the circumstances up until we hit a stage 4C. If we were to hit a stage 4C at 100% reduction in outdoor water use, obviously that's mandating that there is no outdoor watering allowed. So, again, we do not anticipate having to go there. So finally, I wanted to just provide some context for what our customers have done in response to different actions, different budgets over our history. The first is just looking at the total water use data, the per capita per day. Water budgets were implemented in 2009. So you can see that from 2009 until the state emergency regulation in 2013, we remained fairly steady, but we had already dropped from our peak. So during the state emergency was when we had our most aggressive drought stages implemented through the water shortage contingency plan. So you can see then subsequently in 2015, when the 50% ET budgets were implemented, we were already dropping as a result of drought outreach and awareness. And then in 2017, there was a slight rebound after the emergency regulations were lifted, but it does remain low. And as you can see in 2021, we are down to 123 gallons per capita per day, which is a 42% reduction since 1999. And then this chart's a little hard to do because it's very compacted during the last drought, but this shows our annual average of customers that are within their water budgets, which other than the first year, 2009, when budgets were implemented in April of 2009, so that only encapsulates 9 months, the rest of the years we've had 80% or greater customers that have remained within their water budgets. Even across the height of our drought at stage 4C, which was the highest drought factor, and I believe we were at a 70% reduction in outdoor water budgets during that time. for context, 2013 was the hottest year on record. 2014 was the driest year on record at that time. And the height of the drought was really in that 2015 to 2016 window. So due to outreach, due to customer awareness, we were maintaining a very high 90 and 89% water budget at that time. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for April? Director Armstrong?
Yes. This is really helpful. I know I've had conversations with Joe about this, and I really appreciate seeing this information. I think this is another example of Eastern leading the way, and the construction of the water budgets here is really dialed in so closely to the landscape ordinance. And I mean, it's just a great example of leading the way. The concern I have, though, is it's more that I feel like we're asking more of our customers than other agencies ask of theirs, and which translates into almost penalizing our customers when we go into some of these stages and reduce, you know, have to reduce even more, especially when, you know, when we're doing so much. In addition to the water budgets, we just saw the capital improvement program. We're investing so much in water supply, water resilience and reliability locally here that our customers are paying for as well. And then we're asked to just blanketly reduce water use by 20%. Everybody reduced by 20%. It makes it really hard for our customers to meet that when they're being, you know, asked to be much more efficient than other agencies' customers already. So it's just a concern I have that, you know, when we have this 50% of ET, that it's just sort of, I mean, I understand the nexus to it, and it's, again, I think it's leading and it's a great example, but I don't know of any other agencies that are doing that. And even our neighbors, you know, the Western's not close to that. Rancho's not even close to that. And I mean, their 60% ET is for people that have over an acre or half an acre of landscape turf. It was to prevent turf from being, you know, on a couple of acres of land. So I don't know. I didn't know about the floor. So that's helpful to know that, you know, it's not going to affect them anymore until we get to that stage 4C. I appreciate the information, and if it wasn't for the floor, I would have a bigger concern, but I appreciate all of this, so thank you.
Welcome.
Director, any questions on this item?
Yeah, I have a couple, and I agree completely with Director Armstrong, and struggled with this for a long time because, I mean, there's a big article on the LA Times today about you're not doing enough. Governor said reduce your water usage and you're not doing it. Well, that's a blanket statement with no context at all. And we're so far ahead of everyone else that, you know, you can't squeeze blood out of a turnip at some point. So I think we're going to have to try to look at things more in the way of what is per capita consumption by district or region or whatever to really get a better understanding. And I have a question about how do you determine per capita water use? Is it so Eastern sells this much water and we have this many people in our service area, so you divide and that's what you come up with? So does that include commercial landscape? Does it include parks? I want to better understand where that comes from because once again, we're teed up to lead the way on having an impact on non-functional turf, non-residential. And what is that going to do to us? Will it have any effect on per capita? Or are we just talking about residential? And then try to figure out how does that affect us in the future? When are we ever going to get any credit for the administration saying, you know, you guys are so far ahead of the game that keep doing what you're doing, and we're trying to get everybody else in line. So those aren't easy questions, or the answers certainly aren't easy, but I think we need to talk about that going forward.
Dr. Rucker, we appreciate the feedback and the comments, and as well as the comments from Dr. Armstrong, and we agree that Eastern has long led the way for others in terms of water use efficiency and conservation. And I think we are a leader in this space, and I think the state recognizes that we are a leader. Having said that, just a couple of things to maybe consider. Part of the rationale for the 0.5 ET floor, we are, as discussed earlier this morning, we are a very high growth region. We are still adding thousands of new customers a year. So we wanted to provide a framework where we could continue accommodating the growth that we are seeing, as well as use water efficiently going forward. To answer Director Recker's question, the per capita calculation is based on all retail water sales. So we agree that the indoor programs have reached a point where we don't believe there's truly any significant or even any limited opportunity for indoor conservation. The opportunity, as we have seen it, and we believe strongly in this, is the outdoor irrigation. And that is the rationale for us advocating for the non-functional turf management. The more customers we can work with to remove non-functional turf, we will have an improvement in that per capita consumption. Also, our recycled water program has been a key component of us reducing that per capita consumption. When we convert a site from using potable water for irrigation to recycle, that helps us. So it's everything that we're doing. It's not just one thing. I think it's all the programs, all the initiatives over the last many years. But I did want to underscore one thing that April did mention. Given where we are today, I will not be seeking to change our stage in our water shortage contingency plan unless we are compelled to do so. I think our customers have done an incredible amount in responding to our calls and our efforts, and they've helped us be a leader in this space. And at this point, that is not my intent, nor is it our intent. And I've communicated that, frankly, to my counterparts at Metropolitan and others that we talk to on a regular basis. And frankly, what I communicated is I'd like to see other agencies do as much as we have done. I'd like to see other agencies step up and take the kind of action that we have taken. So we are making sure they're aware of where we stand and everything that we've done. Thank you.
If anyone else? Good presentation, April. I agree with all the comments made. We are leading the charge on this, and I want to get some credit for that we are a leader in this. So with that, let's take about a 10-minute break. We will resume at, say, 10:35 for the financing authority, and after that we will do the recycled water rate study. We could reconvene.
It's a very interesting, you know, field to be in. So.
Yeah, it is.
So we have the Eastern Municipal Water District Financing Authority meeting of March 16th, 2022, scheduled for 10:30. I will call the meeting to order. April, do we have anybody wishing to do public comments for the financing authority?
No, not that I'm aware of.
We do not. Very good. Next item is the approval of the minutes for November 17th, 2021. I will make a motion to approve the minutes.
I'll second.
Second by Director Armstrong. Can I get a roll call vote on that, please?
Director Pauly?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
That passes 5-0. Item 3 is our action item, which is to adopt proposed resolution of the Board of Directors of the Eastern Municipal Water District Financing Authority approving an escrow agreement with Eastern Municipal Water District pertaining to the 2016 B bond deference related to Lake Hemet Municipal Water District Phase 1 Agreement Early Payoff.
Morning again. I'll make this brief. As I mentioned earlier, it requires action by the financing authority due to the 2008 bonds being refunded in 2016 by the financing authority. Therefore, the escrow agreement with U.S. Bank includes both the EMWD as well as the financing authority. So the escrow agreement will be signed by both boards, or I'm sorry, by you know, a executive team member of each board, and then the financing authority enters into the agreement. The funds will be received from Lake Hemet Municipal Water District, deposited in escrow, and then later will be defeased once they're callable. That's really just the gist of it. The approving action today is to adopt a resolution and then also authorize a GM, president, or a deputy general manager to sign the escrow agreement on behalf of the financing authority.
Any questions for Thomas? I will make the motion for the item.
Second.
Second by Director Armstrong. May I get a roll call vote, please?
Director Pauly?
Aye.
Director Crona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
That passes 5-0, and we will adjourn the meeting of the Finance Authority.
And President Pauly, the next meeting will be in September. We'll bring the fourth quarter report for the Financing Authority.
Very good.
Thank you.
We will now return to the Eastern Municipal Water District Board of Directors. We are at informational item B, which is a recycled water rate study presentation. Mr. Adams, we are working you a lot today.
Yes, I promise this will be my last presentation. All right, good morning, President Pauly, members of the board. Today's presentation is an informal item and update on the district's recycled water rate study. As you may recall, last year during the budget process in June, one of the recommendations approved by the board was to perform a comprehensive rate study specific to recycled water. The district did engage Carollo Engineers to perform this study, and Alex Bugby is here today to assist me with the presentation. Since engaging Carollo last September, key staff throughout the district have provided significant support. Just want to thank David Garcia, Dave Brown, John Worth, Daniel Carney, and Tracy Lee for all their work so far on this project. Also, could not forget to mention the Planning Committee, both Director Corona and Record, for their guidance and their feedback on this project. A lot of analysis has been done so far by Carollo and staff, and really their insights and feedback have been extremely valuable for the team in preparing today's presentation. Really, the goal today is to give you a very high-level overview of that analysis so far, get any additional feedback from the board before we return to you at least currently planned April 20th. Let me go to the next slide. So here's the agenda for today. You know, I'll do the background. I have a slide or two just to sort of frame what was proposed as far as recycled water rates for the next 2 years and what the history has been. I will then turn it over to Alex to discuss the recycled water market analysis, a lot of analysis on the market for recycled water, which he'll go over in detail. Not too much detail, but enough. Revenue requirements, talk about the wastewater transfer and the benefit for sewer ratepayers, the benefit they receive from the recycled water system. We do have a few modeled rate scenarios, and then we'll ultimately have a preliminary recommendation, and then we'll talk about next steps. So going on to the background and history, a lot of text here. I think the summary is in 2020 and 2021, recycled water rates on average were increased 7%. At the time, operating expenses were increasing about 5% a year, plus there was what we considered a below-the-line deficit, and 2% was the additional rate to start reducing that deficit. We took a very similar approach last budget cycle, as you may recall, with costs at that time averaging about 3.8% plus the 2%, so what staff had recommended was a 5.8% rate increase in both years. Certainly, the board raised concerns as, you know, at some point, unlike sewer or water, there is a market related to opportunities for ag to use other sources of water pumping. How does that have an impact? And so really from that discussion with the board, and that, as I mentioned earlier, the June presentation and recommendation by the board to actually prepare a full comprehensive rate study, including that of market analysis. So at the June board meeting, it was a motion to adopt 1.8%, which was very similar to the potable rate, and then 5.8% in 2023, but with the anticipation that the study would be completed and be brought back to the board and potentially have rate adjustments that would be implemented in 2023. So with that, as I mentioned, a lot of, you know, this is just the timeline so far. What's not shown is sort of the preliminary meetings with the planning committee, Director Record, and Corona prior to the start in September. We did engage Corello, spent, as you can see, a significant amount of data collection and analysis, staff workshops with key members throughout the district. General Manager Joe Mawad was involved in a lot of those workshops, provide great leadership and guidance on that, as well as Laura Nomura. The Planning Committee, we did have a preliminary meeting with them on December 9th, took a lot of their feedback, and then came back with them with a very similar presentation on March 10th. And so today, based on that presentation, we want to give an update to the board. The anticipation is to get feedback today, bring it back to you with a preliminary report and recommendation on April 20th. Should that be approved by the board, we would then start noticing the public hearing for the rate adjustment that we would be proposing to be effective 2023. With that said, I'm gonna.
Can I just add to
yes.
what you had to
yes.
say? We wanted to share that this is really a condensed version of what we took to the Planning Committee on March 10th. We had Director Record and Director Corona, who are very, you know, savvy in ag distribution and the market out there. So we took a lot of information to them. They sat through 2 hours worth of discussion. We didn't want to put all of you through it. I think in the end, and you.
That's not fair. You should make them do it too.
at the end, you know, if Director Corona, Director Record want to share any of the extra information that we provided, we tried to condense it and give you the summary version of it, but we do have the slides available and everything if you need more input. Right. With that, I'll turn it over to Alex.
Thank you, Laura. Thanks, John. Good morning, everyone. So as John and Laura alluded to, we're kind of doing a high-level overview of where we are on the project so far. So the market analysis that we've done, revenue requirements, and ultimately our preliminary rates. Feel free to jump in and stop me if you have questions anywhere as we're working through it, but I'll try to pause at spots, too, so we can discuss things as needed. So first, to kind of look at what our overall study goals are, you know, anytime we initiate a rate study or any sort of cost of service analysis, we like to, in the beginning, kind of lay out what are we really trying to do. And so up here on the screen, we have, you know, how we viewed that as we started off this study. So financial resilience, we want to make sure that our cost recovery structure and our rates are promoting the long-term sustainability of the recycled water program, and that we're really maximizing, you know, the amount of revenue that we're bringing in from those recycled water sales. So we know that recycled water as a service is kind of an adjunct service and kind of add-on to wastewater. So because you're treating the wastewater to that standard, we're able to, you know, then take it and beneficially reuse it. But at the same time, you know, we want to make sure that we're, you know, setting rates such that we're maximizing the amount of revenue that we can bring in from those recycled water sales, while also keeping rates, you know, at an affordable level, so that we can actually maximize the beneficial reuse of that water. You know, making sure that we're developing rates that are proportional for the different types of users of recycled water. So really what underpins the proposed rates that you'll see, and the difference between the rates for agricultural users versus users within the stabilized system, is that those stabilized system users are receiving a much higher level of service than are the agricultural users, who are just connected into essentially the backbone system. Fostering collaboration, so making sure that we're working closely with staff, but then also working with the planning committee, and then you, the entire board, to come up with a plan that everybody can really get behind. And lastly and importantly, compliance with California law. So making sure that whatever rate structure we're developing, how we're kind of setting the cost recovery framework and identifying, you know, what costs are avoided costs for wastewater customers versus pure recycled water costs, those sorts of things, making sure that that's all above board and in compliance with the California law. And in this case, we're kind of under Proposition 26, so proportionality requirements for those users that are taking recycled water as a choice, but then for some users, who are required to take recycled water. We're, you know, working under the requirements of Prop 218. We also have requirements that we need to make under Prop 218 for how we set the wastewater transfer support from wastewater to the recycled water system, because we want to make sure that that's not exceeding the costs or the avoided disposal costs that wastewater customers receive from the recycled water system. And so the first part that we'll go through is our recycled water market analysis. And really, this was aimed at figuring out, you know, what does the kind of overall demand structure look like for EMWD's recycled water? Who's using, you know, what different types of users are taking water and in what sort of relative amounts? And then ultimately kind of going through to what's an afforder, what rates would be affordable for our agricultural users, as they are the users who really are taking the bulk of the water, as you can see here, and really providing the bulk of that avoided disposal cost benefit in, you know, both the amount of water that they take, but also in the way that they take water. So they're able to just kind of take water mostly as it comes and as it becomes available. And so they're really providing much of that avoided cost of disposal benefit for the wastewater customers. But what you can see here is that, you know, based on our fiscal year ending 2021 customer data, at about 640 active recycled water customers within the system, that includes, you know, some of the wholesale agreements as well as the in-lieu agreements. And as you can see on the graph, you know, by far agricultural use is really the largest user group by far. And so within the market analysis, as I kind of alluded to, what we're trying to do is determine what level of rates are affordable for ag users so that we can continue to promote that agricultural use, which gives us, you know, one, the benefit of not having to discharge that recycled water, but then also the kind of other benefits that, you know, come through to the district as a whole, as, you know, we're keeping them off of groundwater pumping, which has benefits to the, you know, the overall basin, and just the kind of soft benefits and other economic benefits of maintaining, you know, agricultural operations within the district service area. And so, as I said, we're trying to maximize beneficial use, reuse of recycled water, also trying to maximize our recycled water revenues, which ultimately results in cost savings for wastewater users. You know, what we're kind of ended up focusing on is really the ag market because, you know, as I said, we're trying to maintain affordability for ag users to avoid them switching over to groundwater pumping. And so the way that we kind of assessed the market was kind of in two ways, and we'll focus more on the first way right now, but it was really estimating what the cost of alternative irrigation water would be, and essentially that would be users switching over to groundwater pumping, and then also trying to understand how, you know, water cost, irrigation water costs factor into any of the agricultural users' kind of overall operations. And for that, we were referencing some UC Davis studies that are periodically published on the cost to produce different crops. So to kind of narrow in on the agricultural user base from that initial graph and table that we showed, you know, this shows, you know, what different types of crops, you know, were identified at kind of a high level within the customer data system as of the end of 2021. And just to kind of show how the agricultural customers sort of split out. And so you can see that we've got 77 total ag customers. Most of those customers are in that yellow band where they're paying I'll call them the normal ag rates. So they're paying about $165 during the summer months, about $97 during the winter months. So those are our kind of typical ag customers. We also have the in-lieu users, so those are the users that have, you know, the in-lieu, ag in-lieu of pumping agreement, and so they pay a lower rate, but that's made up by payments from the water master to essentially bring them up to the rate that those users in the normal ag rates, the yellow band, are paying. Then lastly, we have the demand ag users, and so those are agricultural users that have opted into paying a higher rate that's based on the non-agricultural recycled water rate at an 80% factor, and that's because they need to have access to water at kind of a higher level of service. So they turn on the tap, they get water, they're connected to the stabilized system. And so when we look just, you know, specifically at the agricultural customers, what we see is we've got, you know, about 90% of our usage is from our in-lieu users and then those that are on the normal ag rate, so the R432 and R632. And so because of that, really where we focused our efforts on the market analysis is making sure that we're maintaining rates that are affordable for those users, you know, within the normal ag rates. The assumption there is that those users that have kind of opted into the demand ag rates, when they took that rate structure, they knew what they'd be paying ostensibly. You know, they're able to continue to function paying that level of rates. And so, as John and Laura alluded to, there's a lot of analysis kind of that was done in the background, and we presented at some of the other planning committee meetings, but essentially this is what we were kind of driving towards on the estimated operational cost for pumping. And so what we see here on this graph is a comparison of the blended rates that any of the existing customers are paying, and I'll mention that it's under the summer rates for the R632 and 432 customers, compared to, you know, what we estimated pumping costs to be if they were to switch over to groundwater at a couple different levels of total pumping head. So in the red line, you know, you're seeing what it would look like at about 500 acre feet of head, on the blue line at 300 feet of head. And really the takeaway that we see here is that those ag rates that we have are, you know, basically in line with what it would cost users to switch over and start pumping at some typical levels of the groundwater table, you know, that we've seen within some of the monitoring we had from the district's other wells. So, you know, an important thing here is this is all working under the assumption that those users would already have wells, you know, put into place that can produce and have the ability to pump. So there could be users out there that maybe don't have wells in place or, you know, their wells have been disused for long enough that they would take significant kind of investment to bring them back up to operational standards. So this is really, you know, we're working towards those users that at any time, if they wanted to, could switch over and just start pumping groundwater. Kind of to just sort of jump to our kind of takeaways, and really, as I alluded to, you know, the unit cost of O&M and electricity alone, you know, just to switch over to pumping water is within the range of, you know, what our current rates are for agricultural users. So right now our winter rate is about $97, summer rate $165. You know, if we kind of look at an average level at 300 feet, they're at about $134 per acre foot to pump water, 500 feet, you know, about a little over $200 to pump water. And we did back that up anecdotally with operations, talked to some of the agricultural users that they work with, and they said that, you know, about $200 was pretty much in range with what they'd be paying if they were pumping. Didn't get into much of the detail here, but in looking through the UC Davis studies, there are, you know, it's a study that's put out by the university that's intended to encompass sort of a very like a very typical user, and we know that there's tons of variation between any agricultural user's actual costs, their land costs, overhead, all those sorts of things. So there's a lot of assumptions built into that. Even so, looking at it, I think, you know, it seemed like our current rates, where they are, seem to be satisfactory for profitability, you know, given what those studies look like.
Yeah, I got a question.
Sure.
What does that have to do with anything? I mean, what the district charges for water have to do with a farmer's profitability? I don't know that that's even the district's business. I mean, if you're delivering to a farmer, you're delivering it for a price, and you're delivering it for what, you know, your costs are, or the district's costs are, or whatever you're trying to do. But what the potential for a grower, I don't know that that has any business of EMWD or that it should have any effect on the pricing strategy. You know, I mean, I don't think oil companies are sitting there going, gee, I'm worried about whether this farmer can afford the gas to grow a crop. I don't think they're worried about that too much. It's what they can get. It works differently with an oil company, I'm sure, yeah. Because they're in there for profitability and a water district is not. But I you know, you made that presentation at the thing, and I kept thinking, you know, there was the list of the different crops and things like that. I just didn't understand what that had to do with the discussion.
I think the idea was that we wanted to get a sense of what's reasonable for the recycled water rates, because ultimately we don't want to set recycled water rates at a level such that we're going to significantly decrease the demands. And because the ag users are our right now biggest group of users, we want to make sure that we're kind of structuring things. And as we kind of move through the presentation, you'll see there's, based on cost analysis, there's some flexibility for how much support from wastewater we can justify based on the cost that they're avoiding. And so, you know, really it was just another kind of checkpoint to make sure that we're not setting rates in a manner that we'd, you know, end up adversely impacting our recycled water sales, which then carries through into decreases in recycled water revenues, you know, which ultimately would kind of drive overall increased cost for the district, as you'd have to discharge more wastewater. So I think it wasn't not looked at to be a kind of a direct input for the number that we set the rate at, more looked at to kind of give us an idea of, you know, whether the rates were reasonable and making sure that we didn't end up having any kind of adverse impacts from how we changed the rates.
Well, I think the only adverse problem would be is if you went too high. So,
correct.
I mean,
yeah.
If you go too high, then people are going to stop buying.
And Dr. Kwan, that's exactly what it was. It was just a metric that we wanted to consider, making certain that our rates are, in fact, not too high, and they're not going to have a detrimental impact on our ability to stay competitive and essentially sell the water. Having said that, that metric ultimately is not, as we'll see later in the presentation, is not being used to formulate our preliminary recommendation. The primary metric is the one that Alex discussed, which is the operational cost for wells. That is the primary metric that we're going to use in making, again, these preliminary findings. But to your point, that was just yet another metric that we just wanted to make certain that our rates are not at a level where they're having a detrimental impact.
No, that's fine. I just wanted to...
Yeah.
Point that out. I mean, Go ahead, Randy.
I'd like to make a comment too. And I think, Steve, that's part of why we did the study in the first place, because we felt like the rates were getting too high, and that we're, you know, it's great to get a lot of money for recycled water, but if you can't sell it, it doesn't do any good. And we could just rely on asking our recycled customers, hey, what do you think about this rate? You think we're getting too high? And you and I both know what the answer is going to be.
Yeah.
So it doesn't mean that this is the basis for what we do going forward, but I think it's valuable information just to kind of put things in context. So it may not be the, you know, what really drives our rates, but I'm glad it was part of the study for what it's worth.
So in layman's terms, then it's not to establish the rates, these factors. It's just to understand the cap, a cap on what we can charge based on supply and demand, because it's really critical for us to be under that point of equilibrium.
Correct, yes.
Right? Because if we're not, then we have added costs for maintenance and everything else.
Yeah, exactly. So if we were to do anything that would disincentivize use of recycled water, we'd end up with a higher, you know, higher cost for the district anyway. So we want to make sure that we're keeping the rates in a, you know, at a level where it's reasonable for ag users to take that water.
And then added to the protection of the basin, the San Jacinto Basin, which is harder to quantify. But it's a factor.
Yeah.
Let me ask another question, and this is not on pricing. What, for our most of the areas, let's say in the San Jacinto Hemet area, where I think where most of the ag is going on, what is the basin requirement for the underground? Is it 500? Are they 500 TDS basins, or what are they?
I believe you are correct, Director Corona. It is a TDS 500. Mm-hmm. Now, we've done some studies that shows that may continue to increase, so we need to put forward programs, which we are, to provide an offset to that increasing salinity. And that is, frankly, part of our indirect potable reuse, the purified water replenishment program. It's part of that. The benefit, one of the many benefits of that program, is to create that salt offset. But to your point, yes, it's 500 is the groundwater basin requirements, correct.
Okay. Go ahead.
Thanks. And so from there, there's any other questions on the market analysis spot, we can pause. If not, we'll keep trucking through the revenue requirements and get into some of the financial and rate analysis. All right, so I'll keep going. So revenue requirements really is where we set and kind of determine overall amount of revenue that we need to be generating through our recycled water rates. So there are, you know, a lot of different revenue streams coming into the recycled water fund, even at just a rate level. So we have our, you know, agricultural and non-agricultural rates that, you know, are really our kind of traditional rates that are calculated based on revenue requirements. We also have other offsetting revenues coming in, you know, which include transfer from wastewater, which we'll talk a little bit more in detail in a couple slides. And that's to account for those disposal benefits that the wastewater customers receive from the recycled water system. But we also have a lot of other kind of rates that are paid by users, but they're set based on outside factors. So there are in-lieu rates that are tied just back to potable water rates. And we also have other contract and wholesale rates that are just, you know, increased each year based on a CPI factor as laid out within the agreement. And so what we're focusing on here when we develop rate revenue requirements really is that amount that needs to be generated by the ag users and the non-agricultural users. Some underlying assumptions for the other revenues that are in here would be that, you know, the graph that we'll look at right now assumes that that wastewater transfer stays at, you know, relatively the same level that it's at. And then we'll talk about some potential changes to that later on in the presentation. Mm. And then we're assuming just typical inflationary factors for some of those other agreements that are kind of govern those rates that are charged to specific either retrofit users or wholesale users by agreement. And so ultimately what we're trying to do when we set the revenue requirements is make sure that we're bringing in, you know, enough revenues from our rates plus our offsetting revenues to cover all of our program expenses. And so currently what's kind of in the program under recycled water would be our operating costs. So that's any kind of hard operations and maintenance of the recycled water system, and then that includes any allocated support costs. So things like engineering, you know, operations, development services is all included within that operating cost category. We have debt service for recycled water projects. So that's recycled water's share of the overall debt service based on the projects that were funded with each debt instrument. Those right now are all paid using FPC revenues. So we bring in, you know, a share of wastewater sewer FPC revenues to pay for recycled water share of debt service. And then we have rate-funded capital, which would be any capital project costs that are left over after FPCs are applied, after WSD fees are applied, or after any grants or other outside sources of funds are applied that need to be funded directly with rates. And really that would be things mostly R&R-type projects for, you know, rehabbing and replacing existing system assets. So that's what is kind of currently within the recycled water system and being covered via the recycled water rates. We also have some potential components that right now are held outside the recycled water kind of umbrella and really are funded out of the wastewater fund using other non-rate revenues. So G&A allocation, right? Recycled water right now doesn't receive an allocation of G&A costs, so those HRIS finance type costs, the share that would be allocated to recycled water is held within the wastewater fund, and it's just funded with the non-rate revenues coming into wastewater. We have recycled water OFA, so the operating fixed asset replacement for the recycled water system. And then lastly, retirement costs. So this is would be recycled water's share of the discretionary pension contributions that the district has been making. And so for our modeled scenario, you know, as we've alluded to, there's been a lot of other analysis behind just what we're showing here today. So we looked at several scenarios where we, you know, included all of those costs, just certain components, to assess really what the overall rate increases would need to be, depending on what's included and what we've landed on as our modeled scenario. And, you know, what we would recommend based on an analysis of the costs would be to just include the pension and OPEB costs, or that discretionary retirement contribution, as well as the OFA costs. So the OFA costs are directly related to assets within the recycled water system, so it makes sense to recover those via the recycled water rates. And then those discretionary pension contributions ultimately are tied to the level of staffing within the recycled water fund and the staff that are assigned there, and so it also makes sense to include those. The G&A costs, I think, you know, what we've landed on is that it's probably fine to continue the status quo where those are kept with wastewater, because all of those costs are paid for with non-rate revenues anyway. And so even if we were to bring those costs over into the recycled water fund, you know, they'd come with an associated allocation of non-rate revenues, so it would kind of be a wash anyway. But what you can see is that, you know, based on this scenario, we're looking at overall rate revenue increases of 3% per year for recycled water. And so, as John, I think, mentioned, what had initially been proposed for 2023 was an overall increase of 5.8%. So we're coming in down below that based on this more detailed analysis of all of the costs. So one of the big, well, I can, any questions on revenue requirements yet, or okay to keep moving on to the wastewater transfer?
I'm just going
to
wait until the end.
Okay.
I'll hit you then.
So a big part of what feeds into the revenue requirements, as I said, there's a lot of offsetting revenues, and the largest one by far is the wastewater transfer, which recognizes the disposal benefit that the recycled water system provides to the wastewater users. And so currently that transfer is set based on a set percentage of wastewater rate revenue. So 2.9% of wastewater revenues are transferred to recycled water each year to recognize that benefit. And it works out to about $3.4 million. Historically, you know, that amount has been kind of backed up based on, you know, a high-level analysis of the O&M costs for dechlorination and energy dissipation, which really are kind of the two most direct costs that come up anytime the district needs to actually discharge wastewater instead of reusing it. There is potential to enhance that transfer or enhance that cost recovery of recycled water costs based on all the rest of the costs that would be incurred in the event of discharge. So as I said, right now, the transfer is backed up just by O&M for energy dissipation and dechlorination. However, in the event of discharge, there's also other facilities and assets within the recycled water system that have to be used to discharge that water. And so we went through an analysis of all of the costs within the recycled water system to determine, you know, if recycled water went away, what would you have to do to instead dispose of all that water via Temescal Creek? And so those additional costs would include, you know, further capital replacement for energy dissipation and dechlor facilities, avoided pipeline O&M and capital replacement for those pipelines that are used during times of discharge, and then avoided pumping O&M and capital replacement for any of the pump station facilities that need to be used when disposing wastewater. What that looks like kind of from a numbers perspective is shown in the table here. And so one of the underlying assumptions here, and there's a note under the table, but I just want to highlight that, this assumes that, you know, we would, the district were, what it would look like if the district were to just stop doing recycled water and switch over to just discharging all of the recycled water that's treated. So ponds and storage and the associated percolation and evaporation would go away under this scenario. So it's just, you know, meant to determine the avoided cost that would be incurred if you had to take all of that treated wastewater, you know, pump it and put it into pipelines, get it to energy dissipation and dechlor facility and discharge it into Temescal Creek. What you can see is that, you know, the maximum amount of transfer that we could justify from wastewater customers to recycled water based on their avoided cost is about $6.3 million. So, you know, about $3 million higher than where the transfer currently sits. I think it, you know, important to reiterate that this is setting a maximum that you could transfer based on, you know, needing to meet Proposition 218 requirements for those wastewater customers. You can't charge them more than their avoided cost to dispose of water. So there's nothing that says you have to go all the way up to that $6.34 million. But, you know, what it shows us is that above that current transfer level at about $3.4 million, you have some leeway and some room in there to potentially increase that transfer to help meet our kind of rate goals and policy goals on the recycled water rate side of things. And just kind of looking ahead, but you know, none of the options that we're looking at would take it that high. What we've looked at is, you know, increasing that potentially by $80,000 to $160,000 per year. So pretty minimal increase there to the transfer.
So now I'm going to ask you a question.
Sure.
Okay. So $6.3 million.
Yes.
And at 48,000 acre feet, so it's like $130.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. That's
yeah. And so next we'll kind of get to our rate calculation. So there's an interim step that, you know, for the kind of purpose of time and streamlining the presentation, that we're not kind of going over in detail here, and that's our cost allocations. And so ultimately to get to the rates, we take our revenue requirements, go through a cost allocation process to kind of split those out between what's related to, you know, different functions of the recycled water system. And the way that we've done that here was we looked at things related to the backbone system, so kind of the large backbone transmission piping and pumping, large-scale storage or seasonal storage, and then things that are related to the RRA, which are more things that and costs that are incurred to provide that higher level of service for the customers within the RRA. So specifically, that's operational storage and, you know, pumping costs, so that anytime one of those customers turns on the tap, they're getting, you know, water at a consistent pressure and flow. So once we make that allocation, we then use those allocated costs to come up with the different rates for each type of customer, and that's really what generates the incremental increase from being an agricultural customer who's just on the backbone system, kind of taking water at the mercy of when it's available, versus a stabilized system customer who can turn on the tap and get water whenever they want it. But to jump into our rate structure options, then, you know, part of the way that these options are defined is how we allocate that wastewater transfer revenue among those different cost categories, so, and among those different customer classes. So depending on how we allocate the revenue coming in from the wastewater customers, we can shape what the rates look like for the recycled water customers. We're looking at, you know, so far in this presentation, we've looked at some others, but what we've landed on here is three options. So the first one would be equal rate increases. So basically would take that transfer revenue and apply it to each of the user types such that everyone would have that same 3% increase. The theory behind that is that, you know, the system as a whole benefits wastewater. So any recycled water sold is really benefiting the wastewater users by avoiding disposal. And this is analogous to what's been done in the recent past, where the recycled water rates have been, you know, largely just adjusted via across-the-board increases. Option two is where we would do an even distribution of the wastewater transfer based on the allocated revenue requirements to each class. So we look at the overall amount of costs allocated to each customer class and then allocate out that the wastewater transfer based on the pro rata share of each class's, each customer class's proportional costs. And the theory there is, you know, largely similar, is that the system as a whole is benefiting wastewater. And then lastly, we looked at an option where we hold the aggregates constant. And so we take that wastewater transfer and allocate it to the customer classes such that the aggregates are held constant for calendar year 23 and 24, and then the other rates would increase. And so the idea behind this is that while the system as a whole does benefit wastewater, really those ag users are the ones who are providing the greatest benefit and should be incentivized, as they're taking a majority of the water, and they're also able to take that water, you know, as it's available, rather than having to, you know, take it through the more developed stabilized system. Once we get to the numbers here, you know, so these are the rates that we're calculating for each of the different options that we presented. So, you know, in the blue we see the ag rates in summer and winter, and then over in the green would be the rates for the non-agricultural customers. And so option one, you know, pretty straightforward. We're just applying equal rate increases to all of the different customers by shaping that wastewater transfer. Option two, we'd see the ag rates drop slightly, just because when we allocate the transfer out based on the pro rata share of revenue requirements, you know, we'd see that wastewater would get a bit more of a benefit. So the wastewater rates would drop slightly in that scenario, and our non-ag users would see a greater increase. So they'd see about a 9% increase. And then lastly, in option three, where we hold agricultural rates constant, we would be able to do that and keep the non-agricultural rates to a 3% increase if we increase that wastewater transfer by about $80,000 per year over the current amount. And that would be you know, a very minimal impact to the wastewater fund, and could be kind of absorbed from the kind of operating surplus that's there right now within the wastewater fund. So preliminary recommendation would be to go with option three and increase that wastewater transfer so that the non-ag rates can be held to a 3% increase within the first year. And so, you know, what you can see on the projected table here is our ag rates for non-demand ag rates are staying, you know, consistent through calendar year 24, and then we'd see 3% increases thereafter, and that's really based on our kind of long-term revenue requirement projections. And then our non-ag and demand ag rates would be going up just by 3% per year going forward. The bottom table there, the green table, shows how much we would need to increase the transfer from wastewater to be able to support this rate structure recommendation. So in that first year, we'd have to start an additional $80,000 transfer to, you know, make up for keeping the non-ag rates to a 3% increase. And then going into 2024, we'd have to add an additional about $80,000 to that amount to hold the ag rates constant for another year within 2024. But what you can see is that, you know, even though we can justify up to about $6.3 million, you know, even with these additions, we're still, you know, staying at around less than $3.9 million by the end of this five-year projection. So some of our kind of summary and give our key points. So based on the market analysis, it seems like the current ag rates are, you know, in line and within range of what it would cost customers to to switch over and start pumping groundwater for irrigation. So we think that, you know, based on our preliminary recommendation, option three, where we hold those rates constant, you know, we wouldn't expect to have kind of detrimental impacts to the amount of groundwater that we're, or the amount of recycled water that we're selling to agricultural users. Revenue requirements, you know, basically with 3% annual increases to our overall revenue requirements, we're able to support, including the recycled water share of OFA and share of discretionary pension contributions, which I think makes sense based on, you know, how those costs are incurred and determined. Wastewater transfer, as I said, we can support up to $6.3 million, but for this our recommendation, you'd only need to increase that by about $160,000. What that means for the current year budget, so the kind of the second year of the two-year budget for 22-23, because the amount of additional wastewater transfer is low compared to the overall amount of revenue coming into the wastewater fund, it'd be able to be offset by the net margin. So going with this recommended option for recycled water wouldn't result in any rate increase, any needed rate increase for wastewater for 2023. And then kind of, as I said, our recommendation is option three there, where we would keep the ag rates constant through 2024, do 3% rate increases to the other rate classes. And as we mentioned, that 3% would be a reduction from the 5.8% that was currently approved for calendar 2023. So kind of John touched on the schedule a bit in the beginning, but, you know, where we are right now is our kind of initial board presentation to kind of get the gist of the study out to the entire board, as we've only presented in detail so far to the planning committee. Right now, the plan would be to come back and do another presentation on April 20th, and that would be the presentation where staff would seek authorization to go through the Proposition 218 noticing process and actually set the public hearing for the June 15th, 2022 board meeting, where you would approve the rates. And in between now and the 20th is where we'll work through any refinements and changes that we need to make based on your feedback. So that brings me to the end of my slides, but if we've got other questions and concerns, we've got time to talk. Yeah.
Well, Director Corona?
First thing, so I'm back to the discussion on the wells and things like that. And you had said that we want people to get on reclaimed water. We don't want them to pump groundwater and so on and so forth. So if I've got a farm or a piece of property and I've got an adequate supply of groundwater, even if it's close, I'm not taking reclaimed water. If it was, let's say it cost me $200 to pump groundwater, and it's reasonably good groundwater, I think even if it was $150 for reclaimed water, I wouldn't take it. And reason being is that I have control of my groundwater. I don't have a board at Eastern sitting there saying, well, we're going to raise your price 3% a year. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. I have control of it. Number two, the quality of the water that you're getting in reclaimed water is not as good as what you're going to get from groundwater. I mean, I'm assuming that you have good groundwater. And I mean, I'll use the Scott Lotta deal for an example, high quality groundwater. And they traded out for reclaimed water. Okay? They also pay half the price that everybody else is paying. Not quite half the price, but a lower price. So that's my feeling on that. I mean, it is back in the day when we were all much younger,
it took quite a lot of talking for Eastern Municipal to get a lot of people to do reclaimed water. And they were practically giving it away to get people to take it, okay? They were handing out wheel lines and all kinds of stuff just to get people to take it, okay? And so people did do it, but it had to be, I mean, you're talking $15 an acre foot water back in the day, and that was when, you know, good potable water was $250-$300. So, anyway, that's that point. The other point is, so what do they do? What happens in the city of Los Angeles with reclaimed water? They just dump it in the ocean, right?
Majority of it, yeah. So
who pays for the cost of the reclaimed water then? The wastewater customer, right? Right. So I think that's our starting point. Our starting point is absent the farmers or the recycled water customers that, you know, we're the ones we're making take the water. Absent those customers, the wastewater customer has to pay for the disposal of it. So I think that's our starting point. I don't think it's, well, what can they afford to pay or anything. I think it's a matter of what they would otherwise do if they didn't have people to take this, you know, high salt content water and put it to use. That's my feeling. And so I think we've established that that's $130 an acre foot. So I think you start there, and then you start working backwards. Okay, so now we don't have to do this, and this. So the wastewater customer is actually saving what they would otherwise have to spend. Okay. The piping and the systems and everything to get it to the disposal sites, which the farmers and the recycled water, other recycled water customers, that should all be the responsibility of the wastewater customer. They need to dispose of it. They need to get it where it needs to go. And so I think that's our starting point. And I think that's where you go from there. Simply saying, well, you're already paying $165 and we're gonna slow down the increases. I think when we start talking about this, I was envisioning this like total rework of the system. Don't worry, you're okay. You're giving me this really worried look. I mean,
I'm thinking of.
But I think that's what I was thinking when we started this process. And anyway, that's some of my thoughts. Back to
the thing about people not using groundwater. You know, well, we made a deal with the Scotts and Lotta and said, hey, you don't use that high quality groundwater, we're going to give you water for the winter rate, but we don't offer that to anybody else. You know, if everyone's not pumping because they're using groundwater, well, they should get the same benefit as those. Now, I think it's great that Lotta and Scott's taking the water and putting it to use. I think that's great. But I think if we're gonna have a rate like that, then the other grower, the other farmers, and I would include, you know, the parks and recreation and stuff like that too, because, you know, they could otherwise. We offer incentives for them to go off of potable water and go on to reclaimed water. We give them incentives, you know, because in the future, I mean. And this was brought up in the committee. The vast majority of these people that are using reclaimed water in the ag part aren't the owners of the land. They're tenants. And as land moves to residential, there's going to be less and less people using it for agriculture. So we're going to need to develop those parks and recs facility, the medians and all that kind of stuff. And we need to incentivize it. I mean, otherwise we're just going to simply require it. And that's a whole different ball of wax. So anyway, that's...
So Dr. Corona, I really appreciate the feedback and the comments. And this is obviously very helpful in us charting the path forward. One thing is I did want to actually express my appreciation to you and Director Record for bringing up this issue last June while we discussed the rates. And frankly, it was a result of that conversation last June that we embarked on this effort. So to me, this study, and again, keep in mind, this is the condensed version of the results.
Yeah.
There's a lot more material behind this. It's truly foundational because we have not had a deep dive into the structure of our recycled water rates for many years. Those rates evolved, as you indicated, the history of partnering with the ag industry in our service area and our partners, really. So they evolved, but we didn't have that deep understanding of the market drivers. To that point, a couple of things. I hear what you're saying as far as L.A., but I really don't feel that L.A. is in any way, shape, or form comparable to EMWD. I think it's an apples to oranges comparison. We are so far ahead when it comes, frankly, to any other agency when it comes to our recycled water programs and initiatives. Having said that, to me, what has been the overriding consideration in looking at the rates is to maximize the use of the recycled water, maximize the sales, and maximize the revenue stream so that we can also be accountable to our wastewater customers, who are, you're absolutely right, ultimately they are responsible to cover any gap between revenues and expenditures. But it is also our fiduciary responsibility to make sure we're keeping those wastewater rates as low as possible. To that end, we have always consistently maximized sales and maximized revenue. In fact, earlier this morning when John Adams presented our mid-year financial report, the sales on recycled water were almost 21,000 acre feet during the first 6 months of the year, about 2% above last year. The reason I bring that up is we're not seeing necessarily ag customers at this point start operating their wells and not purchase recycled water. We're seeing a flattening of sales. We're seeing a dampening. There are a number of customers, including the ones we refer to, Scott and Lott, who have reduced their purchases because of other reasons that we've discussed with them. Having said that, we don't want to be in that position. We don't want to be in a position where now our recycled water customers, our ag customers, are in fact turning on their wells to avoid the higher rates of our. We want to be proactive and we want to make certain we're always competitive. That is the rationale behind the recommendation to not increase the ag recycled water rate and keep it at 0%. Although we all are aware of inflationary pressures, we're all aware, we were talking earlier about the cost of energy and the cost of chemicals. So we are going to have to be responsive to those inflationary measures going forward, and we are going to have to look at rates, not necessarily changes in rates for 2023. I think we're confident the budget that was approved and the rates that were put in place are adequate. But beyond that, we are going to have to come back and look at the inflationary measures. So given those inflationary measures, we felt it would be a balanced approach to keep the ag rates at zero without increases while increasing the balance of the other rates.
I'll take the ag rate at zero. Just zero.
0%?
Yeah. No. Zero. The rate. You said the rate.
The rate increases. I apologize for that. For us, we wanted to have a balanced approach. We know it's a it is a lot of information that we are sharing. But I'll go back to the overriding consideration: maximize the sales and maximize the revenue, and continue to be a partner to the agricultural community that has been pivotal to our success on the recycled water program. With that, I did want to just make one clarification that Alex made earlier. You know, we talked about the path forward and the potentially a public hearing. It is going to be a proposed public hearing. There is not a Prop 218 process for recycled water rates. So we will notify our customers of any decision this board makes. Ultimately, whatever that change that is adopted by this board, we are not proposing to make any changes to the wastewater rates. That transfer, additional transfer that Alex referred to, can be accommodated via the wastewater operational reserves. But again, the recycled water rates, as we discussed with our legal counsel, would not be subject to Prop 218. With that, be happy to answer any further questions.
Well, I need to make a few comments.
Sure, Director Record has a couple questions, then we'll get Director Slosson. Go ahead, Director Record.
So I started using recycled water in 1977. It was $10 an acre foot, and it was a royal pain because the system was unreliable, and they would force you to use it in the wintertime. And they couldn't get rid of it. We happened to be in between the treatment plant and the Alessandro Ponds, and so we were a natural. But and we had good wells, but they cost a lot more money. And it was secondary, so you could only grow feed crops. So I've seen the transition of this system go from unreliable and unpressurized to a very reliable pressurized system that costs more money. And I got calls constantly about, I need recycled water. Why can't I have it? Why is this guy getting it? And it was a battle. And Steve, what you're talking about, a lot of it was before Sigma. And so that changes everything. And if you look at the Eastern Service Area, there's very few places that have high quality and plentiful groundwater. Very few. And I get irritated when I hear people that are kind of unhappy with the Scott Lotta thing, when I don't see anybody else coming to Eastern and saying, I've got good wells, good quality water, let's make a deal. I haven't heard anybody do that. So, I think we would be open to that, and it might be a way that we could help with Sigma also. The whole point for me is that we both felt like the rates were getting too high. And we know that one of the biggest ag producers in the service area is no longer growing potatoes. And that changed a lot of things. So we've gone to people calling saying, hey, I need recycled water, to here we are in one of the driest years on record, and we were very close to discharging water. So it's very appropriate that we need to look at what we're charging for this water, and we need to make sure that we can continue to sell it, because we don't want to discharge it. The goal of the district for the last 20 years has been to keep all that water inside the service area so that we don't lose it. We discharge long enough, and Orange County is going to force us to discharge, and we don't want that to happen. We're going to need it for potable use in the future. So we're kind of in a transition period. So I commend staff very much for the study. It was exactly what I was looking for. I understand now how much the sewer generator saves by having a good recycled system, and that there's some flexibility there to keep our rates from going up too fast. And to me, it comes down to supply and demand. We've got to be able to sell this water so that we don't have to discharge it. And it might be that someday the sewer generator pays more for that. I don't know. But I think this is the best study that we've done on recycled water and pricing and all the things that are involved with it since I've been on the board. And it's a basis for going forward. And I'm open to discussing any of those things that Dr. Corona suggested about incentivization or whatever. But now we have a really good basis to work from. So look forward to further discussion.
And I don't disagree with anything Director Record is saying. And as you know, when this comes to the board, I'm going to support it because that's either 5.8% increase or no increase. So what am I going to do? I think the work's been good, but I think there is room for improvement. I hope I sound critical, but I'm just showing my opinion on the thing. But no, Director Recker's correct. Things look like they were getting out of hand and stuff. I just think there are other things we can do. So,
Director Slauson.
Yeah, first I'd say thank you for dumbing it down for me, the presentation. But I do think that the wastewater customer should have some benefit when we have better means or cheaper means of disposal. So if we had a brine line reduction in costs or sludge disposal reduction in costs, I think the wastewater customer should benefit, just as we have, as I think they should benefit from ag, just, you know, eliminating some of the costs associated with disposal and storage and maintenance. But I understand that it needs to be set. It can't be set at the market rate. It needs to be substantially lower based on what you're saying. It needs to really be below, because we can't run the risk of having the ag users get off the system, because it'll cost us so much more in the long run. So I think I support this too.
Dr. Armstrong?
Yeah, I appreciate this report too, and although didn't see the whole report, I think all agencies that have recycled water struggle with setting recycled water rates, because it is subjective and it's different, maybe policy perspectives and you know, just different unique situations to each of those different agencies. So I appreciate it. I learned today that the vast majority of our recycled water is for agricultural purposes. And I mean, how much is agriculture recycled water use annually? 40,000 acre feet of water? I mean,
22,000.
It ranges between 65% to 70% of our total sales.
Yeah. Yes. It's significant. And, I do think that we need to recognize the importance of agricultural water use on a recycled water system and do what we need to do to ensure it continues. And I think we need to recognize also that I think you got to look back in history and realize that the agricultural customers on recycled water really helped this district create a recycled water program. And they should get some consideration for their efforts in the past. I think on the M&I side, on your slide where you say M&I, I'm assuming that's landscape and et cetera.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think M&I customers get other benefits. I think one of them is greater supply reliability in a drought. They're not going to be asked to cut back like our potable customers are going to be asked to cut back. So they get some benefits. I don't think that the wastewater customer in the 6.3 million max, I'm not sure they're the only ones that benefit. I think the potable customers also benefit from having recycled water. Creates more reliability, less import demands, helps the whole region, et cetera. And I think they should have some skin in the game as well, and not just wastewater customers. I think the benefits should be shared between both of those customer groups. And this avoiding discharge. I mean, it's a valuable commodity when you have that recycled water. Someone's going to want that recycled water. I mean, to just say we would dispose of all of it isn't true. I think the wastewater customers own that recycled water after they're done. And there'd be other agencies, there's other people that would be interested in that water. So another reason why I don't think just throwing the whole 6.3 million max over there is right, and I think it should be shared. But I support option 3. I think that makes a lot of sense. I think 3% increases is, you know, very reasonable. If you can keep 3% increases over the next 5 years, I think you're doing a really good job.
And Dr. questions. Armstrong, we really appreciate that feedback. And just to be clear, that 6.4 million that was identified, the intent was not necessarily to suggest that we're asking or we will ask the wastewater customer to contribute that transfer. But I think, as Director Record mentioned earlier, we want to demonstrate the value to the wastewater customer. In the absence of our recycled water program, the wastewater customer theoretically would have had to bear the cost of a disposal system. Now, fortunately, we're not in that position. We haven't been in that position for decades. But we wanted to at least quantify what is that benefit. As I said, I keep going back. This study is truly foundational because we're going to be able to come back to it and update it going forward and bring forward to this board the considerations how we want to manage the wastewater transfer and how we want to manage the recycled water rates.
I have a statement and a question, or a question and a statement. One, or vice versa, or both. I'm glad we have, this was the truncated presentation, I'm glad we have the committee, you know, handling it. And the presentation in April, is it going to be the same? Or?
I think it'll be similar. If we make any changes or refinements, you know, before then, we can include that. And if there, if you think there's a need to get into any more detail on anything, you know, any of the specific elements in here, we can do that as well, since that's going to be kind of the one that's more probably shopped around to the public, since it would be the request for public hearing. So, yeah, if whatever kind of feedback you've had, and if you have, or if you'd want us to include more detail in there, we can.
Or we could that. Make it more concise now that you've been able to see all the details. Yes. So it's kind of the board's discretion, but it will be a request to set the public hearing at that time.
Is the ad hoc committee going to meet again on this before it comes back to the board, or is it no?
No, we were not planning to bring this back to the planning committee. We have, as was shared earlier, we had a very long discussion at planning committee. We got into a lot more detail. But at this point, we wanted to present this information to the entire board. And we've gotten some very good feedback this morning. And obviously, we'll come back in April with a more concise recommendation based on what we heard today.
So let me jump in. I have a couple comments. I mean, first of all, thank you. Great study. I think this is whatever we spent on this, well worth every penny of it. You know, one of the beauties of this board is the knowledge of the members of this board. I think between Director Record and Director Corona, we probably have two of the most knowledgeable people on recycled water in this area sitting on our board. So, I mean, you know, the input is great to have that kind of knowledge of people that actually use the system. Director Record is here from day one of developing the system. My interest in the system, being from more of the suburban aspect, is the green belts and the parks. I mean, I've always said during the most severe drought, I want my kids and the kids in our neighborhood to play on green grass in the parks on the baseball field. And so I have always been a champion of how to expand that recycled water system into the parks and green belts. And we've done that here at Eastern, and especially in my division, I know. So I want to take in the fact that we are going to continue to do that. I know when all new development we're putting on recycle, but I want to continue because that's kind of my area, not so much the ag, but that part of recycled. Make sure that's taken into account. And finally, when we have this public hearing, I'm going to make sure that April and her group, everybody, I know in my area I have some large recycled water customers, and I want to make sure that Valleywide is notified of the public hearing, so if they have input that we've broadcast it far and wide that we're having a public hearing. Even if it isn't a 218 notice, I think we have the obligation to let our larger customers know that, so they're here for discussion. But I think this is a good discussion. I look forward to the next iteration of it and the public hearing. So thank you. Anybody else have any additional? Okay.
All right. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it very much. That will bring us to item 6, is to receive and file various reports and items. I'll make a motion for that. Dr. Armstrong, would you like to second that? Very good. May I get a roll call vote, please?
Aye. Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
That passes 5-0. Jennifer, good morning. We will go to our calendar review.
I'll make it really quick and brief since you guys have been here all morning. Just wanted to give out some reminders about the Water Reuse Symposium on Demand. Does kick off on Monday and goes through April 30th. So if anybody is interested in that, EMWD still has registrations available. Additionally is the Aqua Spring Conference, May 2nd through the 5th. EMWD has two sponsorships for that if anyone's willing to travel up to Sacramento. So.
Can I bring up a point while you're sure. on that? I know that is we have a board meeting scheduled correct. On that Wednesday. I am committed. I'm not going to be at Aqua, but I am committed to going to the customer service event out of town. So do we want to reschedule that board meeting? And since it's in front of us right now, or do you want to ponder
sure,
that?
Sure. I'd definitely welcome the feedback. Let me take a look at that, President Pauly. And I and other staff are planning to be at Aqua on a part-time basis, though. But if the board members would like us to reschedule that board meeting or cancel it, I should say, I would definitely do that.
I will not be available that day, and I don't know if Director Record's going to Aqua or not, but and we don't have to decide right now.
I don't know yet either.
I'm sorry, Director Record?
I'm not sure yet either.
Okay. Let's roll okay. that to the next meeting.
Sure, we'll do that.
Let's make a decision 30 days out or so. It'll be good, okay?
Is the Aqua Conference, is it a hybrid or is it all in person now?
It's all in person.
Okay. Sorry to interrupt you.
Oh, you're perfectly fine. Also attached to your calendar reminder is to let you know there are two State of the City addresses that have popped up for May, beginning with the City of Temecula is going to be May 12th, and the City of Paris will be the following week on May 19th. So on pages 2 and 3 are the board's master calendar. Just two minor corrections on that one. The IE Works meeting was moved from tomorrow, the 17th of March, to the 24th of March. And then the executive committee meeting has also been moved from tomorrow morning to Friday morning, March 18th. So on page 4 are the reminders about the Aqua Conference and other events, the Water Reuse on Demand. Following the 3-month schedule for the board meetings and other committee meetings, pending May's beginning, we'll see how that turns out. Otherwise, lastly, on the final page, on page 5, is the interagency meetings. Western's meeting tomorrow is in person or available via Zoom for those that.
In person here?
It's in person at Western.
At Western, okay.
Correct.
Perfect, okay.
So if you notice any changes or corrections that need to take place on your calendars, please just let me know, or if you need further information on any of the events, I'm also available.
All right, thank you very much. Appreciate that.
No problem.
We will go to director's attendance reports, and we'll start with Director Armstrong.
So speaking of recycled water, the Oasis HOA requested to meet with staff and to look at if there's any opportunities in their community to convert some of their potable water to recycled water from some of their paseo areas to their front yard. Turf landscaping, and so staff gave them sort of what those conditions would be and what it might take, and I think we're updating some numbers to help them look at the cost of that. They also, one of the other ideas that came out of that was maybe removing some of the turf in the front yards and replacing it with some more drought-tolerant landscaping in certain areas and kind of transitioning some of that. But it was a really good meeting, and our staff had a lot of great ideas to share with them. And then the other meeting, Quail Valley Community Group, that was really a request for us to come and give an update to that group on the septic to sewer conversion or subarea 4. And Amanda Fine and myself went there, and maybe 20 people there, I would say. But Amanda did a great job. We gave an update, and it was all well received. And the city of Menifee was there also participated in. And also talked a little bit about the importance of this project to the city. So just really two really good stakeholder meetings. That's all I got.
Very good. Director Corona.
I did not attend the Rancho meeting, so I don't have a report.
All right. I attended the WRCOG Executive Committee meeting. standard items on that. Would like to note that the WRCOG annual meeting is in June. It's going to be at Pechanga, and the guest speaker is Steve Wozniak, who is one of the co-founders of Apple. I think that will be an interesting talk. I did have a good meeting, as usual, with the general manager to update several items. Winchester Mac, Supervisor Washington, was one of the speakers at that, and we gave a water update. Always appreciated that they like having us there. So, Director Record with Met.
Joining in on caucus, Orange County Caucus review of that agenda. Good meeting, standing committee and board meetings. You have a MWD update printout, which is a very accurate representation of what happened. I would say the two main issues were the third budget workshop, and we have the fourth one scheduled for later this month, and then a discussion about Metropolitan entering into project labor agreements. More to be heard on both. EMWD meetings, update with general manager, always good and helpful.
Very good. And then Director Slauson.
Yes, I attended the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce meeting on the 4th, and there was an update, among other things, update from the manager of the Business and Employment Resource Center for the City of Moreno Valley. Attended the RCC Foundation emergency meeting on investments in light of invasion of the Ukraine and supply of different commodities and what, you know, investments were in those areas, aluminum, wheat, oil. Had the a monthly update with Joe. That went fine. And SAPA yesterday, and I checked with Nick before this, we agreed to help Box Springs Mutual Water Company apply for, give them technical assistance for the application with DWR for the Prop 1 Phase 2, Round 1, disadvantaged community grant program, and that's to help them with a well system. It's over $2 million of improvements for Box Springs Mutual, which is in dire need for improvements. They have high nitrates, and so that's essentially what we did yesterday.
Very good. Thank you for that. Do we have any directors' comments, requests for future agenda items?
Sure, I have a comment. Just with regards to Jeff Armstrong discussing the CFDs, because of your professional background, that's important. So I'm glad you opined and told us what your position was.
Very good. With that, Mr. Legal Counsel, I understand we have a need for closed session.
That's correct, Mr. Chair, as identified as on the agenda as items 9, A, B, and C.
Very good. Why don't we take about 5 minutes to switch over to closed session?
Okay.
So we are back in open session. Can legal counsel report out the closed session items for us, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The board met pursuant to government code section 94956.8 to discuss one item of real property negotiations concerning APNs 433-130-022 and 433-150-060. Instruction was given to staff. No formal action was taken by the board. The board also discussed one case of anticipated litigation pursuant to government code section 54956.9. Instruction was given to staff on that matter, and also on existing litigation pursuant to government code section 54956.9, Pollock versus Eastern Municipal Water District. A report was given to the board. No formal action was taken. That concludes my closed session report.
Very good. With that, we'll stand adjourned until April 6th.
Thank you.